like to call to order a public hearing on the 2010 New York State Department of Housing and Community Renewal Community Development Block Grant Program. Is there anyone to speak about this? Jean Lissette.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jean Lissette, Coffman County Planning Department. This is our second public hearing for the CDBG grant application, which has supported our Coffman County homeownership program for over the past 15 years. The program components are going to remain essentially the same as previous years, although we do have two modifications that we would like to put forward. In past years, we included a rehabilitation piece to our grant, and this year we're proposing that the rehab funds actually be used for energy efficiency measures. We're hoping to work with Tompkins Community Action, and so those details are in the works right now. And the second piece is that we're proposing that those individuals that are making 60 to 80% of the median income and are looking to apply to our program, if they are interested, they can actually have their home be part of a housing trust model that INHS is currently putting together. And then instead of it being a diminishing lien, it would actually be a grant that would be offered to them. This has several benefits, one of them being that it will then, having this house be part of the housing trust model, would have it become permanently affordable for future homeowners as well. So that house is part of a stable, affordable housing stock. Participation in the housing trust would be completely voluntary, but it would be available for anyone interested. I will be bringing a resolution to the legislature in March to accept the grant application and to allow us to submit it to the state. Any questions?
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to speak as part of the public hearing? I'll close the public hearing and open the January 19, 2010 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Joel, rise for the pledge of the flag, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call members, please.
Ms. Chalk?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Present.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Present.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
15 members present.
Thank you. First, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence before we begin tonight. Bob Stolpe was a fighter for justice in general and for real people in particular. We will miss him. In a way, the individual personal loss we feel on his death gives some context to the depth of the losses the Haitian people have suffered. Every life is precious. Every passing is a world of sorrow. Thank you. Next, we have proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications on the desks.
And thank you, Kathy. And I have one proclamation. So, Kathy Slaughter. There you go. Kathy Slaughter, Nancy Zaler, Nancy Zook, and Dale Schumacher, please join us. So, whereas President Barack Obama proclaimed January as National Mentoring Month, and whereas every day mentors in communities across our nation provide crucial support and guidance to young people, whether a day is spent helping with homework, playing catch, or just listening, these moments can have an enormous lasting effect on a child's life. And whereas in Tompkins County, over 400 young people each year are mentored by local volunteers trained and supported by community-funded mentoring programs. And whereas there is strong and clear evidence that mentoring is a critical element in any child's social, emotional, and cognitive development, and that mentoring reduces delinquency, substance abuse, and school failure. And whereas the Tompkins County Youth Services Board encourages interested adults to turn their concern for young people into direct action by becoming mentors, I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby recognize January 2010 as Mentoring Month in Tompkins County, and do hereby publicly recognize the volunteer mentors supported by the county-funded mentoring programs One-to-One Big Brothers Big Sisters program and the Learning Web that transform the lives of more than 400 local youth each year, and recognize all the other caring adults in Tompkins County who volunteer as informal mentors by spending time as tutors, coaches, teachers, and friends, and join President Obama in recognizing that, in quotes, our government can build better schools with more qualified teachers, but a strong role model can motivate students to do their homework. Lawmakers can put more police officers on our streets and ensure our children have access to high-quality health care, but the advice and example of a trusted adult can keep kids out of harm's way. Mentors are building a brighter future for our nation by helping our children grow into productive, engaged, and responsible adults. So, thank you. And I would like to, Kathy Slaughter from the Human Services Coalition,
Chair of the Youth Service Board. I'd like to thank you for this recognition to programs that have such a clear benefit to both youth and the families in the community. Appreciate that. And I'll...
Dale, would you like to come up?
Well, I wasn't really prepared. Good evening. It's a great pleasure, as always, to join you, just to share a comment or two. I also bring you greetings from the organization in the community that has been relying on mentors since 1972. That would be the Learning Web. Every year, we use hundreds, literally hundreds of adults throughout the community as they give of their time and their talents and their energies to mentor youth and to show them what the world of work is all about. We find that collectively these mentors give some 20,000 hours annually to 700 different young people throughout Tompkins County. It's incredible the work that they do, all as volunteers, and the impact and the power that they have in the lives of young people. It certainly makes that transition from adolescence to adulthood smoother for each of those that's able to participate. Certainly, thank you for this proclamation. I think, indeed, it's a way to celebrate mentors, and I hope that the press gets the word out that mentors are so very, very valuable. And certainly, thank you to all of you in Tompkins County and to the legislature for providing the resources so that we can have these types of programs and that we can continue to bring up that next generation of leaders. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
To follow on Dale's comments, if in fact there are any adults in the community who would like to give of their time to serve as a mentor but are not sure exactly which program might be a good fit for you, I encourage you to call the Tompkins County Youth Services Department at 274-5310 or check our website to get connected, and we can talk with you more about the details of the Learning Web, the one-to-one program, and some of the other valuable programs in the community. So we encourage you to take action, and we can help you connect. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you all. Thank you. There are no special orders of the day. I do want to say before going any farther, at the end of last meeting, a number of people said they couldn't hear me very well and couldn't hear other people. So I want to make it a standing rule that if you can't hear, just raise your hand, just wave, make us know that you need people to speak louder, okay, including myself. Privilege of the floor for the public, and I have Carl Graham signed up.
Good evening. My name is Carl Graham. I'm the Director of Community Relations and Development for the Alternatives Federal Credit Union. This evening, we began the eighth season of our Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which is a program the county has graciously supported. Last year, we helped over 1,400 families and individuals bring in almost $2.8 million in federal and state returns into this community. We anticipate we'll bring in even more money and help more people this year because of the economic difficulties so many more people are facing. So I just wanted to come and alert you all to the fact that the program has started, and to urge you to tell your constituents, your family and friends who may qualify, to come to us and get their taxes done for free rather than spending the $130 to $200 they might end up spending at a paid tax preparer who probably won't do as good a job as our volunteers will in making sure that they get all the credits and full refund that they're due. So the program started today at the credit union. Excuse me, I'm going to have to read here for a moment. Program will run from today, January 19th to April 10th, Tuesday through Thursday, 3 p.m. to 8 p.m., and then Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. We'll have a site in Dryden at the town hall. That'll begin on January 30th and run on Saturdays, February 6th and February 20th, March 6th and March 20th, and April 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then at the Brooktondale Community Center, that'll be on Mondays starting February 1st and the 15th, March 1st and 15th, and April 5th. For appointments or for information, individuals can call 211, which is information and referral for Tompkins County. So just dial 211. If you're outside the county, it's 877-211-8667. And again, we thank you for the support and the funding for the program. Those funds you give us are leveraged many times over for the money that it brings in. If there are any questions, again, 211, or feel free to call the credit union. Any questions right now? Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to speak? You don't have to have signed up. All right. Now, I don't see any municipal officials out there. I don't recognize anyone. Am I missing anybody? Okay. Privilege of the floor for legislators. Kathy.
Thank you, Martha. At this time, it's my honor and privilege to invite Mary Arlen, John Nord, the parents, Mary Lee Nord and Timothy Nord, up to the front so that I can award the Distinguished Youth Award. Come on up the sign. This is one of the coolest jobs that I have. It's so rare that we get a chance to really recognize and honor youth in our community and to specifically highlight the good things that they're doing. There's a folder, and we ask people to submit their nominations, and it's always a difficult task to go through it. And I also usually put out a call asking for more nominations. And this year, it was very interesting because I went through the folder and I liked what I saw and I pulled a few out. And I had also issued the call and I got an email. And sometimes something just jumps out at you. And the youth depicted in the email nomination for Mary Arlen was the kind of person I admire. Someone that takes initiative, somebody that sees a problem and thinks independently about how that can be fixed, inspires other people to action, and follows through on it themselves. I think that Mary can talk about it in more detail, but it's just really an honor today to be standing up here with John and Mary and Mary Lee.
It is my pleasure to nominate John Nord for the Distinguished Youth Award. As John was formulating his Eagle Scout project, he recalled his middle school science class field trips to study ecosystems in the woods behind DeWitt Middle School. Although crossed by a nice little stream, the woods were a mess of fallen limbs, pathless, and with no place to sit and take notes. So John went back to his DeWitt principal, Mr. Ron Acera, and DeWitt science teacher, Mr. Gary Strong, to design a plan to revitalize the woods and stream area behind the school in a natural way, using fallen straight limbs to line the paths, mulching them, and building picnic tables and benches to create an outdoor classroom study area where the teachers can take their classes for a wide variety of learning activities. It was an ambitious plan, but John recruited 24 scouts and adults to help, arranged with the town of Ithaca to donate and deliver 3 loads of mulch, procured picnic table kits and benches, and, with his parents' assistance, arranged for pizza for lunch. That's very important. The September workday was warm and sunny, and the project was successfully completed by 4 p.m. that Saturday afternoon. The DeWitt Middle School administrators and teachers are thrilled with the results. The leadership skills John has learned in scouting extend into other activities. Since his freshman year, he has been the principal French horn player in the IHS orchestra and also plays first horn in the band. This year, he is participating in chamber music ensembles selected by his band director. John enjoys collaborating with other section leaders to promote school spirit for the pep band at home football games, demonstrating instruments to elementary school students, and encouraging middle school students to join the band when they enter IHS. John also is a dedicated swimmer and is co-captain of the men's swim team at IHS, where he typically swims the breaststroke and individual medley. In a swim meet a week ago today between IHS and Horseheads, John broke pool records in both events. On 22 December, when IHS beat Vestal for the first time in many years, John volunteered to swim the 100 backstroke and the 100 freestyle instead of the breaststroke and individual medley, and he won both events. His coach, Mike Armitage, commented, quote, "It's more of a testament to his leadership ability. He cares about his own personal times, but he's willing to sacrifice them for the team," end quote. In addition to qualifying for the state finals in varsity swimming, John has achieved junior national cut times in USA swimming. Through all these activities, I have watched John morph from a shy little child into a confident leader who, with the contributions he is making to our community, is most worthy of the Distinguished Youth Award.
I just want to say, without the generosity of the award sponsors, Cayuga Radio Group, Purity Ice Cream, B&B Awards and Engraving, and Bang's Ambulance, we probably wouldn't have the huge overflowing box of items to award the youth with, and we really appreciate that. And also, can't help it, Frank brought this up a few years ago and thought it would be a great idea, and I think of Frank every time I get this opportunity. It's great when individual legislators figure out ways to build community by honoring members of the community. So at this time, it's an honor and a privilege to present this award, but afterwards I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you if you've got something to say. Fair warning, okay? And how about we do this? Yeah. I'm learning. Usually I forget and I do all that stuff. So that handsome plaque for B&B Awards. And here we have something that probably is a first aid kit, a gift certificate from Purity Ice Cream, some T-shirts, maybe coffee mugs from the Cayuga Radio Group and other special prizes that we don't get to know about. And you can do with it as you please. Thank you very much, and I'm going to ask you to shake my hands. Do you have a diffuser?
So I don't know what Mary was saying about morphing. I think I'm still a pretty shy guy, still. So I just wanted to say a couple of things. There are so many people that have made me into who I am today, who have influenced me when it comes to the path I took with my life. Some of them are here, and others could not make it, but I'd like to take this opportunity to thank them all the same. First, I'd like to thank Kathy Luz Herrera for selecting me to receive this distinguished award, and Mary Arlen for nominating me to receive it. Without them, no matter how much hard work I've done, this would not be possible. When it comes to that hard work, though, there are many others I'd like to thank. Nikki Zowell, my band director, for teaching me more about music and my own instrument, and for putting up with me for the last year and all of this one so far, too. George Myers, the orchestra director, for bringing me into the symphony orchestra program at the high school and making it seem more like a fun activity than a stressful performing atmosphere I imagined when I graduated from middle school all those years ago. Mike Armitage and Joey Hamilton, my varsity swim coaches, for refining my swimming abilities and teaching me every day I've known them more about myself, not only as a swimmer, but also as a leader and a person. Ronna Sarah and Gary Strong for helping me organize my Eagle project I did back in September for DeWitt Middle School. Also Justin Tate for being a great friend for I don't know how long, ever since the days when we throw rocks out at Cayuga Lake and Camp Barton Family Camp. He's always been there by my side. And even now, two summers ago at Philmont, still keeping me sane during a 75-mile hike out in the middle of nowhere. Mr. Tate, for being an amazing mentor to me on my career to scouting, always helping me when I need it and watching over me, and also being a significant help to me on the long trek at Philmont. Lastly, and certainly not the least deserving by far, my parents, for backing up all my ridiculous ideas and following me through everything I've gotten myself into. They've done everything for me, from supporting me financially to physically and also mentally. When I need it, they're always there for me. Without all these people, I would not be who I am today, and I owe them everything. I'd like to thank you all once again for being all I could ever ask for in a teacher, coach, advisor, or friend, and for being so much more to me.
Thank you. That's terrific. Thank you very much. Great to meet you. Are there any other legislators who'd like to speak to the floor? Frank.
Good choice, Kathy. Whoa. I just want to remind the board that yesterday was the kickoff, in my capacity as the chairman of TCAT, that board of directors. Yesterday was the kickoff with the new roots, and also that's R-O-U-T-E-S, just to make sure there's a distinction. And also the TCAT, the new passes. One change that, if you haven't already done it, if you have a pass, the paper passes are now obsolete, and you should turn them in and get credit. You can certainly go over to the new stop on Green Street, the Gimme Coffee stop, and exchange the pass and load up on the new one. Brian already asked me a question this evening about a stop in Groton and in the McLean area. If you run into any constituents, this is a work in progress. We're going to have glitches, undoubtedly, with the new routes. But if you run into any, the individual can call TCAT directly, of course, 277-9388. 277-9388, and it changes to a word. I think the word is right. Or ask Pam, who's a director, Kathy Herrera, who's also a director, or myself, where your representative's on that board, and we'll try to get the answer for you. But I thought it'd be good to remind people that this is taking place. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you, Mike.
Several people have asked me since the beginning of the year, what's the legislature doing now? And we are in that time when we aren't making a lot of noise, but a lot of things are going on. there are different kinds of county government throughout the state. Many people don't understand that. There are the old boards of supervisors, there are county executive forms of government, and there are the kinds of government that we have where we have a committee system which works through a county administrator. I personally think our system is excellent for our county because it allows us to change and be flexible. Each year we begin by electing a leadership team and by having new committee appointments. And that it refreshes our committees, gives a new set of eyes often. We don't have the same people every year for years and years and years in the same positions. And I think that's a healthy thing for us, and I think it's something we should be proud of. So we're in that reorganization mode right now, and we'll get into the swing of the full committees and a lot of business very shortly. But I think it's fine to reflect a little bit on what we have as a form of our county government and why it works so well in Tompkins County, where everyone has an opinion. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. I have Leslie.
If you're keeping up with the news, we know we continue to support by words and by deed the residents, victims, the families in Haiti that suffered such a devastating earthquake. I remember sitting on this legislature floor, might have been 4 years ago, when the hurricane hit Haiti and caused major damage. So I got this email today, and it was a sobering reminder because headlines change and people forget. And so I thought I'd take this opportunity to just remind all of us and the people out there that those in Haiti still need our support. I got an email today that came, and like I said, it was a sobering reminder. It was a 6 point, six sobering points is what it was called. One says, have you ever been without water? Hundreds of people in Haiti have no access to clean water since the quake hit. Have you ever been in a place that has no water? Just a thought. There's more to it. The other one said, which, as someone who works with children, really rang or hit home to me hard. Half the people in Haiti are kids, and they were hungry before the quake. Over half the population of Haiti is 15 years old or younger, and they were hungry before the quake. A great friend explained to me that most of the people of Haiti wake up every day not knowing how they will eat dinner that day. So there are no reserves, no soup kitchens, no pantries, nothing for most. Hunger started immediately. Toxic stew of death is brewing. Take hundreds of thousands of people, shock them with a major earthquake and dozens of aftershocks, take away their homes and put them out in the open, take away all water and food and medical care, sit them out in the open for days with scorching temperatures, surround them with tens of thousands of decaying bodies. They are getting sick. There is no place to go. What happens next? It is grim. It is hard. It is horrible in Haiti right now. And those are just three of the six sobering points that I wanted to mention as a reminder to all of us that every penny matters. There is one place for the Red Cross that you can send text messages. I think it's 90999. Text Haiti. There is another site of text messaging and foundation site, and I don't remember exactly what it is right now, through a musician, Wyclef Jean, who is a native Haitian. You can look him up. His name is spelled W-Y-C-L-E-F-J-E-A-N. And every penny matters. So as you leave here, and for those of you who are watching, please be generous. At the GEC breakfast on Saturday, we were very thankful, and I want to publicly say thanks to the people who came out and donated you know, just in our penny jar, $500+ that will go towards that relief fund that will go to the Red Cross for that. So please, 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 I'm begging of you as a daughter of the Caribbean to reach into your pockets and help out. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. And that's so well said, and I just encourage people to dig deep and then dig even deeper. I mean, it's going to be ongoing ongoing need, and these are our neighbors, and we really can help. Is there anyone else? Carol?
I want to give people information about the one next step that is going on related to people's concerns about gas drilling in this area. There will be a rally and lobbying day in Albany, at the West Capitol, next Monday, January 25th. There is a coalition of group, hundreds of New Yorkers coming to fan out and lobby and rally first on the West Capitol Park, the west side of the New York State Capitol building. At 10:30 to 11 a.m. is when the rally will start. There are buses. This is being sponsored by the Citizens Campaign for the Environment, Environmental Advocates of New York, the Sierra Club Atlantic Chapter, and Catskill Mountain Keeper, among others. That Sierra Club Atlantic Chapter is the one that our own distinguished chair went and spoke at their rally in New York City, or press conference in New York City. There are at least three of us, three plus on this body, who've been involved in helping think through some of these next steps. There's a TCOG gas drilling committee that is thinking through how to approach the people who represent us in other ways. We're watching the news from the DEC and from the governor, and this is one step that citizens can take to come out and have a voice. There are buses being organized from many places, and one group that is organizing, that I know of, that's organizing a bus from Ithaca specifically is through Sarah Hess, sarahhess63@yahoo.com, leaving from at 6 a.m. from the Ramada Inn near Pyramid Mall, but you need to sign up for that in advance. They're asking for $30 for the bus, and but there is money available to bring that as low as $10 for those who would like to go that way. So I encourage people to consider coming out to that. You should be hearing more about it from the press, hopefully, during the next few days. But it is a week from yesterday, so there isn't a lot of time to make plans.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks.
Anybody else? All right, we have no special topics, but for my chair's report, I have a number of appointments and some remarks. So, first, to my fellow legislators, thank you for your confidence and support. I look forward to working with each of you this year, and I'm anxious for us to roll up our sleeves and get to work. To Joe and the entire staff, it's a privilege to work with all of you. I have great confidence that our team will tackle the difficult problems ahead with compassion and creativity. The start of a new legislative term is a great opportunity with new members to bring into our group. So welcome Brian, Dave, Pat, Mike, and Peter. As we answer your questions and bring you up to speed, we all get to see things with fresh eyes. Last week I had the opportunity to meet with Stu Stein, who was chair of this body from 1994 to 1996. We talked about the initiatives he and the board of the 90s had worked on. I realize that many things we take for granted today were problems that the legislatures had tackled back then. For example, how can we stimulate economic development, enhance intermunicipal cooperation, or improve relations with our local colleges? Today, we depend on TCAD's leadership in stimulating business growth and retention. Through the Tompkins County Council of Governments, all the county's municipalities are working together on common goals. As for higher education, this past year, Cornell University, the City of Ithaca, and Tompkins County together established the Housing Fund, our unique partnership working to create more affordable housing. My conversation with Stu helped me recognize that as slowly as government sometimes seems to work, we can make things happen when we have a goal and work toward it together. I thought about the solutions county government had been part of over the years, and I wondered what solutions we might create that future legislators will take for granted. Our budget challenge this year will certainly be the number one issue for us. How we address it could shape county government and, in many ways, Tompkins County itself for years to come. So we must find new ways to think about our programs and organize our work. Joe is developing a roadmap to look ahead 3 years, longer than we've managed to do before, and that's a good thing. But I submit that 3 years is not long enough. This economy will improve. We will see employment rise again and sales tax receipts with it. And most importantly, if we make the right investments, even now when it's hardest to do, we will position our community to rebound ahead of the curve and be ready for even better things in the future. We've solved very difficult problems before. As a result of this county's consistent innovation and creativity, it's not a stretch to say that we are seen as a leadership county by others. We initiate programs that other counties often join in or try to emulate. A few examples of this, going back years, are countywide assessment, the Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, and organizing other counties to fight unfunded state mandates. New York State recognizes this leadership as well. When they wanted to try out a new kind of justice court, the state's highest judge knew that Tompkins County would be a good testing ground. Our Department of Social Services was asked to be one of the first to pilot online applications for DSS benefits. Our Planning Department, Solid Waste Division, Youth Services Department, and Airport have all received national accolades in recent years for their innovative work, to name just a few. And I apologize to the other 23 departments that I didn't have time to name. So how will we invest our precious resources, people, time, political will, and money to prepare for a better future? I think these are some of the next challenges that will demand our leadership. Gas drilling will quite possibly transform our region. Our grassroots community is providing statewide leadership, and TCOG, the Council of Governments, has brought municipalities together to speak with one voice. I've asked Carol Chalk to be the point person on this issue, to help the county work with others to protect the land and the way of life we hold dear. Global warming is every bit a local problem, and our planning department is leading the effort on many fronts. For example, they're working to create a green loan program with the potential to insulate and weatherproof thousands of buildings and create hundreds of jobs. As with many of their initiatives, they're seeking outside resources to leverage our own. As we meet tonight, between the anniversaries of Martin Luther King's birthday and the inauguration of President Barack Obama, we recognize the need to improve the diversity of our workforce. Especially when hiring is very limited, we must find better ways to get better results. Last year, Cornell grad students studied our records and identified specific areas we can target, and we need to act on their recommendations. Our tourism program, another unique program in the state, would be even stronger with the kind of professional focus that the Convention and Visitors Bureau has long provided to the marketing effort. This is the year we will make that happen. And Paula Younger, our Deputy County Administrator, will focus her impressive skills on securing outside grants and other resources. Her sights are already set on rural broadband service. Tompkins County should work to become an even stronger voice in our larger neighborhood, within NYSAC and with state government. At every level, we must continue to lobby for issues we care about. The best defense is a good offense, and we will work to make sure our voice is heard. Even while the unprecedented budget gap will force us to make hard choices, let us not forget the importance of investing in our future. Every other county faces similar choices. How we respond could have ripple effects if we find creative solutions that others find worth emulating. With Joe's and Jim Dennis's leadership on the budget committee, we will get through our immediate budget woes. I'm confident that this body will take pains to consider the fairness, the immediate impact, and the future ramifications of each choice we make. It's crucial to be as informed as possible when making these hard choices. That's why I've invited our department heads to take turns making presentations about their programs at each of our legislature meetings this year. I believe it'll be time well spent. To Joe and our staff, to legislators and agencies, to volunteers and the public, we will need the help of each of you in the coming year to navigate these tough times. But we can do this. The ingenuity, the generosity, the passion for what we do are not just hallmarks of Tompkins County government. They are essential qualities of Tompkins County's people. These qualities frequently put our community on the top 10 lists of places to live. These qualities help lure people like Joe Marianne and his family here from a secure job where his boss asked him to stay. So we must nurture these qualities. This economic slump won't last forever. It's our job to steer a course through it and position our community for even better things in the days and years to come. Thank you. So to carry out all this work ahead of us, we have a structure of committees that closely follows that of past years, although I've gone back to basics with a couple of committee titles. So I'm grateful to each of you for your willingness to serve in these roles, and the committee list is in your folders. As Mike wrote me recently, there's a lot of talent among everyone here, and trying to make it all fit to produce the best performing team for 2010 is the goal. I want to especially thank Dooley for her help and advice through many conversations that went into this committee configuration. So the 2010 committees in alphabetical order and their members. Budget and Capital, and that's the name, Budget and Capital. Jim Dennis, Chair, Kathy Luce Herrera, Vice Chair, joined by Pam McAsee, Peter Stein, and Brian Robison. Facilities and Infrastructure, Dooley Kiefer, Chair, Leslie McBean Claiborne, Vice Chair, Pam McAsee, Mike Lane, and Dave McKenna round out the committee. Government Operations, and that's the name. Mike Lane, Chair.
No, this G Power, though.
No more G Power, that's right. Actually, Budget and Capital was maybe going to be, is it Budget, Capital, and Human Resources, but the acronym was Butcher, so didn't really go over so well. So, Government Operations, Mike Lane, Chair, Dooley Kiefer, Vice Chair, Carol Chalk, Dave McKenna, and Pat Pryor. Health and Human Services, now this is the exception for what Mike Lane said about somebody serving a long number of years. Frank Proto will be chair of this committee again because he's just unequaled in chairing this.
You sound disappointed.
No, it's fantastic. That's why you're there.
It's continuity.
It's important and we appreciate it. Will Burbank, vice chair, joined by Nathan Shinagawa, Jim Dennis, and Kathy Luce Herrera. Planning, Development, and Environmental Quality, Pam McAsee, chair, Carol Chalk, vice chair, Will Burbank, Frank Proto, and Pat Pryor. That gets the award for the most popular committee. And Public Safety, Nathan Shinagawa, Chair, Leslie McBean Claiborne, Vice Chair, Jim Dennis, Brian Robison, and Peter Stein. There are two special committees that we'll have this year. The first is the Census Committee, which has already started its work under Pam McAsee's leadership. She's the chair. That committee includes Frank Proto, Carol Chalk, Kathy Luce Herrera, and Mike Lane. We expect they'll meet through July 2010, when the Census Bureau will complete its work on the ground. And our thanks go to many community members who have already started working with Pam's committee to ensure the broadest possible count in Tompkins County. The second special committee will be the Capital Plan Review Committee. That is, the acronym is CPR. So I will chair that committee. I'm going to get my CPR certification updated on that. I'll be joined by Dooley Kiefer, Vice Chair, along with Mike Lane, Kathy Luce Herrera, and Frank Proto. This group will review the 20-year capital plan that was adopted in 2006 and consider possible revision of priorities since the Health Department building is nearly completed. Additions to the plan may also be considered and will make recommendations to the full legislature as warranted. So all that's in your red folders. Are there any questions about that? About those committees? Dooley.
Will the special committees have written charges?
I think the Census Committee already does from last year.
Have what?
You have a written charge?
Yes. Well, yes, we do, of sorts.
Of sorts?
Well, I mean, and we yes.
I think there's a charge, and I can work on something specific for capital plan. That's a good suggestion. Now, also in your red folder, I think on the left side, is a draft calendar. And after Kathy worked this out, after the meeting tonight, I'd like to have everybody will break up and meet in the committees as we're assigned, and we're going to try to establish the meeting schedule and see if this works out. Kathy's put this together with attention to deadlines for the legislature meeting deadlines. So it will be there's a purpose to the dates that she's chosen. But if those dates don't work out, then obviously that all has to be sorted out. We'll do that at the end of the legislature meeting tonight. So, Julie, do you have a question?
No.
Okay. And then there's another sheet of appointments in your folders that include chair's appointments that we'll be going through. Now, some that I need to read. Okay. And there's a sheet that says we'll be done through the committee process. That's Tompkins County Council of Governments, the IDA, Workforce Diversity and Inclusion, and the Special Negotiating Committee. Those will go through committee process, and that's in your folder. But I will make the following additional appointments. To the Tompkins County Area Development Board of Directors, Will Burbank. To the Chamber of Commerce Board, myself and Jim Dennis as alternate. To Cooperative Extension, Will Burbank and Dave McKenna. Local Advisory Board on Assessment Review. Now, these are for each town or municipality. Caroline and Danby, Frank Proto, Newfield and Enfield, Dave McKenna, Groton, Brian Robison, Dryden, Mike Lane, Martha Robertson, Town of Ithaca, Will Burbank, Dooley Kiefer, Peter Stein, Lansing, Pat Pryor and Dooley Kiefer, Ulysses, Jim Dennis, and the City of Ithaca gets five of you. Carol Chalk, Kathy Luz Herrera, Leslie McBean, Claire Bourne, Pam McAsey, and Nathan Shinagawa. And I expect that you will work out the times for those meetings, how you'll split up that time. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean Clairborn to be appointed chair. Ethics Advisory Board, Dooley Kiefer chair. Cougar Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization, Peter Stein. Cougar Vet School Incinerator Project, Dooley Kiefer and Beverly Lucy. Again, a long-term appointment that we deeply appreciate. Ithaca Metropolitan Planning Organization Policy Committee, Dooley Kiefer, Pam McAsey, alternate, Workforce Investment Board, Carol Chalk, and Civil War Commemoration Commission, Kathy Luz Herrera and Frank Proto. So, did I get everybody, Kathy? Okay, good. Any questions on those? All right. Again, thank you all for serving. It's a very, very important part of our work. So, County Administrator's Report.
Thank you, Martha. I have two items on my list to report on tonight. The first is to request the legislature's confirmation of an appointment that I'd like to make. And the second is a very quick and preliminary report on the budget that the governor released earlier today. So I'd like to take those in that order. First, with the request for the legislature to confirm an appointment that I propose to make to fill the position of an interim supervising attorney for the assigned counsel's office. This is something that we haven't had to think about or do for a long time. I think you know that Bob Stolpe served in that position well for 32 years. So we had to bring out the books to remember how this process goes to fill that position. But quickly upon the passing of Bob, the ABIR, which if anybody wants to know what the acronym is, it's the Advisory Board on Indigent Representation. I had to write it down. The ABIR board came together and found that there is a need to appoint an individual to do the supervising attorney work on an interim basis while a search for a permanent replacement occurs. And at that meeting of the ABIR, there was a list of potential candidates to take that interim position that was developed by that committee. It was in rank order. Soon after that meeting was held, Kelly Dam, who's the president of ABIR, went out and began to talk to those potential candidates. And the good news is that the first person on that list, Wesley McDermott, was good enough to say that he would be willing to serve, subject to your confirmation, in that capacity on an interim basis. I have done a bit of due diligence on Mr. McDermott. I'm fairly new to the community, but I do know some attorneys, and it's amazing to me that an attorney has been practicing as many years as he has an incredibly good reputation among everybody in the community that I've talked to, and is poised to serve very well in this capacity. So with the recommendation by the ABIR of Mr. McDermott to me, we also went to the Public Safety Committee to vet that suggestion. Public Safety unanimously endorsed the idea of the interim appointment. And when I say interim, we're talking about between 90 and 120 days while we conduct a search for a permanent person for that position. This is a very much a part-time assignment. It's roughly a third of an FTE in terms of cost. The proposal would be to do this by contract as opposed to appointing a person to a county position. So with all of that in mind and with, again, the vetting process that has occurred, I am recommending your confirmation of my appointment of Wesley McDermott on an interim basis to the position of supervising attorney for the assigned counsel program. Mr. McDermott is here if anyone has any questions. As I understand the process, you may choose to take this up as soon as I'm done with this presentation and take a vote on confirmation right now.
Pam Sawyer.
So I'd like to move that we appoint Wes McDermott, the interim head of the board.
Seconded by Kathy. Kelly or Wes, would you be interested in saying a few words? You don't have to, but...
Good evening. I've been practicing here for 40 years, and I've participated in the assigned counsel program for all of that time. I had the pleasure of working at one time for Frank Albanese, that's how long ago it was, and then Bob for 32 years. I certainly don't or won't pretend to replace Bob, but I can promise you I'll do everything in my power to keep this the quality program that it is, one that we should be very proud of, and that I'm proud to be a part of, both as a participating attorney, but also if it's your pleasure as the supervising attorney at this time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Brian.
Not a question, just I think that's an excellent choice, certainly on an interim basis. I've known Wes for a long time, and during my law enforcement career, I can tell you he was very passionate about defense. I was the wrath of some of that, so I know. And I would encourage him to, if he likes it, to pursue the permanent position. I have that much respect for him personally, and I know he's very well respected within the criminal justice system locally.
Thank you, Brian. That's great to hear. Mike?
I'd second exactly what Brian said. As a member of the bar myself and having the pleasure of serving with Wes over the years, I've seen the breadth of his experience in the criminal law stage, and he's taken all kinds of cases, including the most serious of felonies, and I think he'll be terrific.
That's great. Jim?
I know Wes from being an elected official when I was on the city council many, many years ago, and we saw fit to try to shut off the water to the town of Lanton. And what it really made for was Bolton Point, so you can thank the city for that. But I'm so happy that he wants to do this job, and he'll do a great job for us.
Anyone else? Carol.
I just want to make sure, Wes, that you're prepared for the line-by-line analysis that we've started on of that 500-page document that anybody's warned you about.
I have read the report itself. I have not read all of the appendices. I won't kid you, but I will and get up to speed, and I note that there are a number of proposed changes that I think are positive and will be helpful to the program, and we'll do everything that we can to implement them in a manner that's going to be helpful
to all of those who practice in the program, and it's a good program. We'll keep it that way.
Thank you. Welcome.
This is just a question for a county administrator. Was there something sent to us before now regarding this appointment?
No, it was. This has happened very quickly. We did go to Public Safety Friday.
Okay.
To vet.
Thank you. I don't have anything against Wes.
Mike?
I just also think we should thank Kelly Dam for going out and finding it.
Kelly, do you want to say anything? Kelly's chair of ABIR.
As chair of ABIR, what we did at the most recent meeting was empower me as chair to find the appropriate nominee, as well as ensure that it was approved by the president of the Bar Association, which I did, and approved by OCA, and I met with Judge Mulvey and got that approval. We then took our nominee to Public Safety last week, and we are now here for confirmation. So we did follow the process that was created many years ago without having to do this process many years ago.
But we did it really fast.
Very fast.
I'm a county rep on the ABIR, and it was a good discussion, a thorough discussion, and a very strong choice for Wesley. And OCA is the Office of Court Administration. We're going to start really getting in the habit of naming our acronyms for a while, too.
Yes.
All right. Are we ready to vote? All in favor of the nomination of Wesley McDermott for assigned counsel interim basis? Raise your hand, please. That's unanimous. Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And just to kind of put a punctuation mark on this, we will be beginning a search process soon. Kelly and I have already begun to talk about the composition of a search committee to look for a permanent appointment to that position, and I will inform you as that process moves forward. The other item on my list, and I will be very brief. The governor did release his proposed budget earlier today, and I would just like to give you a very preliminary report on what we're seeing so far in that budget. First of all, the challenge that the governor faced was quite significant. The deficit that the budget attempts to close is $7.4 billion. The proposal the governor has made would balance that with $5.6 million in spending cuts, $1.9 million in new revenue. Much of that revenue is in the form of new taxes on cigarettes and sugary soft drinks. I can't find better words for that. But a significant amount of revenue to be raised through those two sources. In terms of its direct effect on our budget, I think those of you on the legislature understand that it's much more difficult to determine the specific impacts of the state budget on counties than it is on other levels of government. A school district, fairly simple to figure out the formula impact on its budget, same thing with cities. In the case of counties, the revenue that we get is all determined by formula, and it's all by program. So you really have to go page by page through the budget to understand the specific impact on the county. And when we talk about this budget at the beginning of the process, we have to emphasize it is the beginning of the process. And by the time this budget gets to the finish line many months from now, it probably won't look much like the budget the governor proposed. So you have to keep that in mind. In terms of kind of the high-level things that we're seeing in this budget, the governor has, we think, held to his promise not to do the sleight-of-hand maneuvers that's so common in state budgets, where there are subtle formula changes in the way costs are shared in mandated programs that end up meaning lower state costs but higher local costs. And based on what we've seen so far, at least in the major programs, we believe the governor has refrained from that kind of burden shifting that we've seen often in the past. Specifically, the two welfare programs, the formulas haven't changed. The Medicaid cap has been preserved. There's some other preservations in there. That's very important to us. There are some delays in increasing the amount of the public assistance allowances, delays, not cancellations of that, that should result in a little bit of savings for us on the good side. There's also a proposal for additional video conferencing that could help in some of the assigned counsel costs that we're seeing and transportation costs. There are, again, a number of things in this budget where it appears that the governor has tried to hold true to the commitment not to shift burden. There's also a proposal in this budget to allow governments to amortize some of these giant increases that we've talked about in pension costs. And we're going to have to put a pencil to that. I can't tell you what the effect of that's going to be, but that is a proposal in the state budget. In fact, I think that's how the governor has taken some of the high peaks off of his own budget, is by proposing to spread the cost of those pension increases over a number of years. So there are some things on, let's call it, the positive front that we're seeing so far. There are some negative things that are beginning to come out as well. It looks like there are some reductions in funding for public health. What are called optional services in public health would be affected by funding reductions. Looks like an across-the-board effect on probation departments of about 10%. Some reductions in long-term care. These are some of the high-level things that we're seeing already, but again, there's a lot of details in this budget that we're going to have to study over the next week or two and report back to you on specific impacts. We're also concerned about the effect of this budget on agencies that we either sponsor or support directly, like the community college. A very significant reduction in aid to community colleges, about 11%, that would affect TC3. It appears that there is a reduction in aid for transit agencies like TCAT in this budget as well. And there are reductions in human service programs that may bypass us, but may affect the agencies that we deal with directly. So over the next week or two, we'll be trying to tease out the details of what this budget does to us and reporting through the Budget Committee on those specific impacts. So again, it's a mixture of good and bad. We do appreciate the fact that the burden shifting that was so common in the past doesn't seem to be the case here, although there's still plenty of pain that we will experience because of this. So again, as we get more information, we will provide you with the information, and I'll close the way I opened. This is day one of a very long budget process, and by the time we get to the finish line, whenever that is, a lot of what we've talked about here will probably change, and we may have new challenges or we may have better news to report, and I'll do my best to keep you posted as those changes occur. That's my report.
Frank, thank you, Joe.
Joe, we were specifically mentioned, Tompkins County was specifically mentioned in one instance in the proposal, and I realize what you just said, that it's very preliminary, but the closing of the Lansing Women's Facility, are you aware of any provision for the folks, for repositioning the folks who are housed there, not to say anything more than the jobs that will be lost?
I will tell you, the governor's representative...
I think that's just one wing.
It is.
That's what I was told.
It is one wing. And the governor's representative reached out to us this morning to let us know that was a part of this. And it is one wing. There's a commitment there to work with the employees affected by it. And as I understand the plan, it would occur over a 12-month period. So there might be time for the state to be able to accommodate some of those people affected.
Any other questions for Joe? County Attorney's report.
Just a couple of things. The first thing is primarily directed at new legislators. As you probably see, I handed you out a confidential memorandum. And just to explain basically what it is, every 4 to 6 weeks or so, I try to update the legislature on the lawsuits and matters that the county attorney's office is handling. This is obviously just a small bit of what we do, but I try to update people so that they know what's going on. And sometimes we discuss some of the when major things are going on in executive session, but please feel free to contact me about any case or any matter that you have any issues with, because that's really the purpose of it, so that everybody on the legislature is informed of what's going on and can ask any questions you may have. Also, I want to say just a couple words about Bob Stolp. Bob, as you all know, was the head of our assigned counsel program for 32 years. He was absolutely great at making sure that everybody who needed it had not just good but excellent legal representation. He really kept at it like a hawk. But he was also a county employee, and we got to work with him for many years. And he was really a great guy. And
I, and I know I speak for every county employee, really liked him very much, and it was a real privilege to work with him. That's my report.
Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate that. County Finance Director, David.
I distributed in your mailboxes tonight, just before the meeting, the final accounting for sales tax for the year. And I know there was a report last week about, and the county, the good news is this county acted quickly to the slide in sales tax revenues that this whole state experienced. We reduced our budget by $2 million in the sales tax, and I'm happy to say that even though the fourth quarter was sluggish, we ended up the year 5.4% below last year. That represents $1.6 million less income for the county and the county's budget. But we did manage, by reducing the budget early in the year by $2 million, we did manage to actually exceed our revised budget estimate by $200,000. So I don't know, probably not a lot of counties that managed to do that, end up positively, though we did, to remember, we were the beneficiary of the FMAP income, which allowed us to offset the reduction in the cost of Medicaid, allowed us to offset the cost, the decline in the sales tax revenues. That's you know, a fairly positive thing that we reacted quickly and resolved that problem. But like everybody else, it's going to take a long time for that sales tax base to build back up. We're starting, normally the county's fiscal position is supplemented at year end by excess sales tax, and that goes directly to the fund balance. Well, this year that's not going to happen. Everything's going against us, so you can. We have to deal with that reality. I also put in your box a listing, an updated listing of the properties that were exposed to foreclosure as of the end of the as of January 15th. The final day to pay came and went, and we ended up with about 29 properties still with exposed to being foreclosed on. This is originally we started off with 99 properties. In the last month, we've taken in $400,000 in delinquent taxes. And so where we were started off with about $500,000 in delinquent taxes due from these properties exposed to foreclosure, we're down to about $100,000. And that was a really positive result. And but you have this list of properties, and if you know any particular circumstances about any of the property owners on the list, please let me know. We go out and visit every property to investigate exactly the circumstances that exist. But if you know anything about any of them, please let me know. And that's my report.
Thank you, David. Any questions for David? Frank.
Dave, aren't you going to remind everybody that taxes are due a little later this month, 1st of February, and make sure you pay them on time?
I hope everybody pays on time.
Thank you, Frank. Carol?
Yeah, I just have a question about the trends in terms of the number of properties.
Typically we have about 150 parcels exposed to foreclosure when we send out the notice of foreclosure. And we typically have about 35 parcels going into that we have to go investigate. So actually, we're a little below where we usually are. We probably have a little more residential, but I know some of the circumstances there, some really aren't residential properties anymore. There's been a couple that have been destroyed by fire that are not homes anymore. So we'll have a very small auction, which is a good thing. What the next big issue will be, will we see any trend with return school taxes? coming back from Ithaca City School District returns about this week sometime, we should be getting and see if there's more parcels returned unpaid than the previous years. Last year we were pretty stable, which is a very positive sign. And so,
thank you. And David mentioned FMAP. That's the Federal Medicaid program. That's the share that we get from the feds, 50% share for every dollar of Medicaid. And as part of the stimulus program, the federal government increased that share. We got a couple million dollars extra over 18 months, something like that.
1.8 in 09 and another 1 million expected this year.
So that's helping us out in the general fund, but that's that acronym. Okay, consent agenda. Resolutions to be added or withdrawn? Pam, you have a lot of action tonight.
Yes, I feel a little bit like a banker. I'd like to withdraw two resolutions. Resolution I and Resolution F, or F and I. And I would like to move that we add Resolution N. And I would like to explain why I'd like this added. This was passed in December by the Planning Committee. I took it off the agenda last month for our legislative meeting because there were still some questions about it. Those questions have been answered, and it's ready to move forward. It's authorizing the execution of an agreement with New York State Department of Transportation, Job Access and Reverse Commute, and New Freedom Rural Assistance Grant, 2010. And I so move.
Second by Frank. I'm going to rewind a minute and give you permission to withdraw those two resolutions. I think they will both be gone. Resolution F, the bylaws on the Tompkins County Development Corporation, it's my understanding PDEC will be looking at it again next month at the next meeting. Good. And the AES Cayuga resolution will come back to the legislature at the next meeting, and we will have a presentation tonight at the end of our meeting. Joe's going to give us a bit of a history and explain the payment in lieu of taxes that this is referring to. Steve Witcher is planning to come. He's the county administrator who was part of the negotiating team, as well as Jerry Goodenow, plant manager for AES. So we will take time to have a thorough discussion. We're putting this at the end of the meeting because it's possible we will want to go into executive session to cover some sensitive material. But so the resolution on AES, the resolution I, is just being held back till people have time to get comfortable with it and ask questions, and we'll look at that again at the February meeting. So then we have a motion and second, moved and seconded to...
I did.
Yes, that's been moved and seconded, and it is resolution N. This needs 10, Frank seconded, needs 10 votes to put it on the agenda. All in favor of adding this to the agenda, please raise your hand. That looks unanimous. Thank you very much. That will cover, we will get to the end of the meeting. And so we'll move to the consent agenda. Resolution A, in support of H.R. 1362 and S. 1273 to establish permanent national surveillance systems for multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, and other neurological diseases and disorders. Resolution B, authorization to accept funds, execute contract, and budget adjustment, Healthy Neighborhoods Program, Health Department. Resolution C, authorization to accept funds and budget adjustment, Office of Homeland Security, Preparedness Funding, Health Department. Resolution D, to amend resolution number 14 of January 20th, 2009, determination and certification of county clerk's allowance, annual expenses for administering mortgage tax. And the revised version of resolution E, approval of contract for arts and culture development grants.
Off, please.
That one comes off. Is there, and I'll read the appointments on the consent agenda. Also in your folder. Environmental Management Council, Helen Slatcha, Sarah Adams, and Anthony Guarneri. Empire Zone Administration Board, David Sprague, Nels Bone, and Michelle Benedict Jones. Office for the Aging Advisory Committee, Pamela Jenkins Smiley. Advisory Board on Indigent Representation, Christine Shaw. Criminal Justice Advisory Alternative Incarceration Board, Richard Bennett. And Emergency Communications Review and Oversight Committee, Douglas Cotterill and Thomas Boyce. Is there a motion for consent? Moved by Frank, seconded by Will. All in favor? Please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you very much. So we will start with committee reports, workforce diversity and inclusion. Leslie Bean Claiborne, Chair.
We will meet next Wednesday, 3:30, at the Bevelo State Conference Room in the DSS facility.
Thank you. And I will mention just that the new members that will go through committee, well, Kathy Luce Herrera is a continuing member of WDAC, and Pat Pryor is members volunteered to join WDAC, and that will go through committee, but you're welcome to go to that meeting. And in fact, there are slots, additional spaces, if any other legislators would like to join WDAC. Just that would go through the Budget Committee, Budget and Capital Committee, which will oversee WDAC this year. Thank you, Leslie. Legislative Rules and Procedures Committee, Dooley Kiefer, Chair.
We think we have finished our work. We have placed in your red folders a document called Proposed Changes to Rules 5 through 16, and we hope you will read that and be prepared to vote, hopefully to accept them all, at our first meeting in February.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions? That's great. God, you know, you had a year to do it, and you did it. Congratulations to Frank and Mike Hatter as well. Health and Human Services Committee, Frank Frodo, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Health Committee did meet, and most of the work that we accomplished at the committee has already been reflected on the consent agenda. But I did want to compliment Stacy Shackford from the Ithaca Journal. She had a disappointing news on the youth services program update and how it translates it not only locally in program support, the 4% cut, but also the 7% municipal cut that is going out to the municipalities. I thought I was speaking with her before the meeting tonight, and that kind of news is never good to be giving, but unfortunately it has to be, because it affected every single municipality in the county that is participating in municipal youth. The next meeting of the Health Committee will have to determine after the meeting this evening, when the new committee comes together. We may have to, those of you that received the email today and had a chance to check it, we may have to move the meeting day to the fourth Tuesday. We have a member that unfortunately can't get there on the second Tuesday, so we can talk about it after the meeting's over. Thank you.
Any questions for Frank? Thank you. Government Performance and Workforce Relations Committee. Nathan Shinigawa.
The committee has not met in January. We had other than our quick meeting right before the legislature meeting, in which we already passed the resolution that we passed. So I have no report.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm sorry, I skipped over Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. Last one would be Chief Claremont, Chair.
Our facilities are fine. Our roads are hanging on. Our airport is booming. They told me we have nothing to talk about, so we will not be meeting on the 21st.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? That should be easy. Oh, there is a question. Kathy.
Well, actually, it's a comment. I saw a press release about employments that was very encouraging, and I'm curious as to whether anybody here wants to brag about that, because it sounded pretty good.
Well, that's
and
why.
Just people that have heard me, you know, complain in the past about the airport will be pleased to know that I just about jumped for joy when I saw that. So,
well, there you go, Kathy. You bragged.
I did?
Well, I was, As I said, our airport is booming. At our last meeting, it talks about, you know, just having three airlines, all the differences made in terms of our employments from last year to this year, the numbers. We are certainly outgrowing our competitors, and so we're encouraging people to fly, fly, fly. You have to go places, and encourage those who are coming in to come through our Ithaca-Tompkins Regional Airport. It is really doing well, and we are seeing a difference because of the addition of a third air carrier service, so we're excited about it. The more you fly, it's the more they'll be encouraged to stay at the Tompkins County Regional Airport. So, please, if you're listening to me out there, do fly. And our fares are pretty competitive. We're getting to that point. So, yes, we like that. Good news is happening with facilities and infrastructure.
Nathan.
I just wanted to say the last two times that I was on an airplane, I flew out of Ithaca, and the fares were cheaper, and then out of Syracuse and Elmira both times.
You're the best, Nathan. I was getting ready to throw my pen because I thought you were about to say Elmira.
Now, does anybody, the numbers are astounding. Something like better than since 2000, right?
Do you have the numbers on you, Ed? Because I don't know them right here.
It's the second highest, I think, ever.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing.
I mean, have you seen the temperature?
Ever.
Absolutely
over
amazing.
109,000 planes last year, the third highest number in history of the airport. Mm. So, in the most sense, be well before 2000.
That's
so
true.
It's quite a mark.
Thanks, Kathy, for bringing that up. That deserves a little bit of airtime. Thank you, Ed. Anything else? All right. Planning, development, environmental quality. Pam Maxey, chair.
Well, I don't have anything quite as dramatic as that. Follow up your report, Leslie. That's wonderful news. Okay, well, I'm going to start with, the committee meeting that we had last week, we actually passed most of the resolutions that you see before you, so I don't need to talk about them. And also the ones that we withdrew, we talked about at our meeting. It was a lively discussion, but there really wasn't a huge amount that I felt that we needed to report today. So I would like to start going through the resolutions. Let's start with Resolution E, Approval of Contract for Arts and Culture Development Grants. And I so move.
Carol seconds. Thank you. Jim.
A couple of comments. First of all, I'm clearly going to support this resolution because I value and I believe all of us value the work of the STP board and all they've done. My concern is about the State Theater and their ineligibility to receive any money from room tax this year. It's my understanding from having some small conversations with people that it is centered around membership in the ticketing organization. And what I'm hoping to accomplish, not tonight, but in the future, is that, again, a discussion is held with the group from the State Theater and STPB to see if there is another way through another fund that the room tax money might be distributed to the State Theater. And I think if, having been involved in this legislature for 4 years, reasonable people can make reasonable decisions, and clearly this is a place where discussion takes place about almost anything. And I guess I want to at least have one more discussion with this group of people, or listen to a discussion about this issue and see if there can be some resolution to it. But other than that, I will clearly support this resolution.
Pam,
I forgot to mention that the version that we are passing is the revised version. The revised version was the version that we passed at the PDAC meeting. The revised version is in your red folder and not the one that was attached to your agenda. I just wanted to make sure people knew that.
Any other comments? Ready to vote.
Well, sorry, what's the difference in the revised version? I'm sorry.
The original copy included the figures that were crossed out in the revised one. And when we passed it with those figures not there. They didn't need to be there.
All right.
You see, I mean, and it was basically a chart of everybody who got funding, and the other things just didn't belong on the chart. So we asked that they be removed.
Carol.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to reiterate that neither the STP, the committee involved on the STP that did the grants review, the STP or PDEC felt like this was any reflection on the status or the desirability of the state theater, that we, you know, encouraged them to apply to other grants programs, that it was as I understand it, Pam, please step in if I'm butchering this, that it's a matter of the guidelines and the way they've been written, and that, I mean, I think we should encourage the STP to take another look at, you know, what those guidelines are, and the State Theater to look at what other of the STP programs it's eligible for, and we require request that all of them go back, as they have done pretty consistently over the last few years, to try to work out this matter of the ticket center and make sure that it can meet everybody's needs and have the community working together. And I think the intent is to do that, as I understand it. I don't know if this is something we want to ask Brett Bossard, who's back there, to say anything about at this juncture, but certainly this is just one among many matters we need more staff for the STP to help us deal with all these questions.
Now, I think maybe we can, it's clearly a committee conversation. We don't need to have the full conversation right here. So I think I'd like to move on. I saw Leslie's hand next.
Well, Pam was offering an issue. You probably will answer my question, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, I sat on the committee that looked at these grants, and I supported not giving the fund to the State Theater. There is money available if the State Theater decides that it wants to join the ticket issuing program, then there would be money available that they could apply for. But that, as we had the criteria laid out, this did not meet it. It's been several years in a row where an exception has been made, and the exception had been made in the past partly because they had a contract with another company. This year that contract was expiring. It was a perfect opportunity for them to make the change. The change would not have affected their operations because by adding them to the program, they would have been able to add staff to the ticket center. And it would have been able to accommodate the State Theater. So they made a choice in this, and we felt that there was a choice that we needed to make, and we are hoping that that will change in the future.
Thank you.
You're all set then? Okay, then I saw Jim and then Kathy. You had your hand up,
didn't you? Yes, I did, but I'm just waiting to see if there's anyone else. I'm really sorry that I wasn't precise enough in saying I really didn't want to do the discussion now. I was hoping we would do it at a later point.
Okay. Kathy?
Thank you. Since I'm not on the committee, I keep up with it through the agenda and the minutes and the notes, and it's real helpful to me to be able to understand some of the details of the discussion, and sometimes I think the public benefits from a better explanation, as Pam gave, and based on what I read in here, I'm willing to support this tonight.
Okay, and I would just say STPB is the Strategic Tourism Planning Board. So, are we ready to vote? All in favor of the resolution? Raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Pam. Next.
Resolution G, making it a negative declaration of environmental significance in relation to Resolution Number H of 2010, authorization to hold a conservation easement on tax parcel number 12-1-30, located on Brookendale Road, Town of Caroline, and I so move, and I would like to point out that it is the revised version that I am passing, that it's in your red folder. I mean, I'm proposing.
Is there a second? Frank seconds.
Okay.
Is it G?
Oh,
H is revised.
Sorry,
G is not revised.
You're right. I'm
okay.
Sorry. I give my...
That's all right. So we're doing G.
G.
Fair enough?
Yes. And no revisions to that one.
And no revisions. Any questions? All in favor, raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous. Resolution H.
Okay, Resolution H. Authorization to hold the conservation easement on tax parcel number 12-1-30, located on Brookendale Road, Town of Caroline, ID number 1728, revised version. And I so move.
And Frank seconds.
Make a comment?
Yeah.
This property is right in Brookendale. The comment that I received from one person, and I want to clarify it, this was done entirely with the consent and approval of the owner of the property. There was some question about whether or not this was an eminent domain proceeding, and it is not. It is simply a conservation easement that permits the planning department to act as the shepherd for the dollar amount that's mentioned in the resolution. It's less than $150 a year just to go out and make sure that the property isn't being used for anything that the owner of the property didn't want it used for. So it's simply a conveyance and a vehicle to preserve a nice piece of property right along 6 Mile Creek.
Kathy and the mic.
Thank you. I see from the map that it's kind of adjacent to 6 Mile Creek. And is there wetlands involved or anything like that?
No.
Just curious.
Mike.
I just want to point out I was pleased to see that this resolution speaks about the consultation about this matter with the Town of Caroline Planning Board. And I think it's so important that we consult about these things with the towns and villages.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ready to vote? All in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Okay. Resolution N, authorizing, this is the one we added.
Right.
Authorizing the execution of an agreement with New York State Department of Transportation, Job Access and Reverse Commute, and New Freedom Rural Assistance Grant, and I so move.
Frank seconds. Any discussion? All in favor? Raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Tim, you're on roll. Okay.
Oh, great.
Anything else for PDAC?
No, that's it for PDAC.
Then Census Committee.
Okay. The Census Committee met last Friday. We had more people than we had before, and we also had Janice Young, who is the census from the Census Bureau. She came and talked to us and answered our questions about the upcoming census. And we also had some folks from ITS come, and they have mapped the results of the 2000 census. And so you can look at a map and see the rate of return in the different parts of the county. I have put this map up on the bulletin board behind me, and I think that you will all find it of interest to look at that map at some point. I would like to point out that there's this very red spot out in the village of Trumansburg, and the red spot indicates that there was an under 50% involvement return rate, and evidently what has happened is that it wasn't that the village of Trumansburg didn't get their forms in, they think. It's because some of the people who were from the village, their names have been included in the Seneca County count, or that they had been included in the count outside the village. So that one is one that is less worrisome. Some of the other areas that where we had low return was College Town. That's a very major concern because we have so many students, and if they don't participate in the mail back, they aren't here when the Census Bureau hits the ground. So that's an area where we really need to focus some of our attention. Another area that that has a relatively low return rate is some of our rural areas, in particular out in Dryden. And the feeling is that they are basically the trailer parks that we had a low response rate in that group, and so it's something that we are working on. We all need to be involved in this. It is in all of our interests to get our count up over 100,000, and because of the money that we will be available to receive will increase. Well, historically that's been the case. What remains to be seen now. But anyway, we have begun to gear up. We have beginning to target the different groups in town who are historically are undercounted to make sure that they are counted.
Thank you very much, Pam. Nathan.
Pam, if I had people that I thought would be good contacts for you in reaching out with certain populations, should I just give them your name and in what capacity could they help the committee? Can they go to the committee meetings?
Are these students or are these?
Both students and permanent residents. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you could just you could have them. I mean, they can't go out and fill out the forms.
Right.
They can encourage people to fill them out. They can set up information tables. If it's an apartment with a large number of people, you know, they could encourage them all to sit down together to fill out these forms. If it's an ethnic group, I mean, we are working with the ethnic groups in terms of language barriers, cultural barriers. Anybody who's in this country, I mean, you don't have to be an American citizen to fill out the census form. Anybody can fill out the census form. If you are in Tompkins County at the time you receive this form, then you are there to be counted. So certainly they can contact me. That would be fine. Or they could come to our next meeting, which I will be happy to tell you when I know it.
Okay.
So it will be soon, though.
Okay.
And Marshall Lynch is part of that committee. And I saw Will and then Jim and Pat.
Well, you just answered the question, which was when your next meeting was. But,
oh, yeah.
Is it not correct, Pam, that not anybody can fill out, but we hope everybody will fill out? Because, as you pointed out, it's really to all of our advantages for an honest accounting. And I think there can be fear among certain groups that filling out this form puts you at risk if you are perhaps worried about your status legally in this country. And my understanding is that there is no link between the information gathered here and other agencies. It really is.
Yes, that's right.
And I guess my question: are we going to engage in any sort of large scale public awareness on this campaign?
Yes, Marsha Lynch came last Friday and brought some of the people from her advisory board. They've scheduled a meeting on the 28th, and we're going to sit down and put together a whole media campaign. So I mean, because these things are bailed out mid to late March, and the whole the Census Bureau campaign, they're out starting on the 1st of April. So this is going to happen really fast. This is not a long term. The whole thing will be done in terms of the public piece of it, of collecting information, by the end of July, pretty much. I mean, I expect they'll do some cleanup work after that, but all of our work, all of the agency's works in town will be done by the end of July.
Jim?
Yeah,
Jim, Patton, and Carol.
I'm really sorry to hear there was a red spot in the middle of Truensburg and not a blue spot. But maybe we can invite people to the Rongo and have the beverage of their choice, and we'll count
it
them when they come through.
Pat?
Well, some of my questions were answered, but the only other one is this map available either electronically or in a hard copy or something?
Good question. I'm not quite sure if it's there yet, but it will be. They promised us that they will put them up on the website. But what is also really cool this time is that as the returns are coming in, as the census forms are being returned, the Census Bureau will keep a tally on their website, so we can actually go there and see what we're getting in terms of return for the different areas as we go along here. So that should be a real help.
Carolyn and Frank.
I just want to stress that my understanding of what we volunteered for in this committee is not to take all of your ideas and be the ones to go out and implement the ideas about how to make sure people are reached. And I hope that people aren't just going to call Pam and say, here, Pam, this is a great idea. You go do it. I mean, I think that it's incumbent on all of us to go back to whatever constituencies we have and help figure out how to use the knowledge we have of our districts or our areas to get people to fill out those forms and to let them know that there is no correlation of any databases anywhere with the information that gets put onto these forms. The President of the United States cannot look at these forms for 72 years, yeah. Or 75 years.
72.
Can't look at these forms. They cannot be correlated. The purpose really is to get a count. So any of us who have ideas, if Truemansburg is, you know, the beverage of a choice, maybe Nathan and I can compare notes with Jim on how to do that in College Town. Trade ideas, but I would encourage all of us, you know, and I'm happy to sit down with Nathan and the other, maybe try to call a meeting of the city reps. I mean, that would be my idea of how to reach people in that population and whatever other constituencies, whatever other listservs you've got, whatever other ideas you have. What the Complete Count Census Committee will do is put you in touch with the literature, the maps, the ideas, Marcia. So I just, people should think, ask not what we can do for you, but what you can do for.
If I can suggest that it sounds like the public information campaign is not formed yet and will be, so suggestions maybe for how to do that maybe ought to go to Marcia, and you know, we don't have to air them all right here now. So, oh, should we? Okay. Whatever. I've got Frank, Peter, and then Brian.
Thanks, Martha. Just to reemphasize the absolute necessity, the import statewide is that we're in danger of losing a congressional seat, maybe even two. And we came so close 10 years ago to having 100,000. I think it was 98.6 or something like that, and we were really pushing to get the 100,000. It's a critical number. And I just want to remind Jim that the red in Truemansburg probably will extend to Massachusetts tonight. And we'll find that out after 9 o'clock.
Oh, there goes the bipartisanship.
That's called.
It's joking.
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused. I understand the problem. I sure understand the problem. If we're hovering around 100,000, then it'd really be good to be above it. And I also understand that I'm being asked to accept this as my personal problem. But I haven't the vaguest notion of what I'm supposed to do. I'm completely... I don't even know if I returned something. I don't remember returning anything in the mail.
Okay, well, why don't we...
I just don't understand what's being asked of me, okay?
Okay, the Census Bureau will send out a questionnaire to every address in Tompkins County or all over the United States towards the end of March.
Ah, okay.
And then people should return them, and when towards the end of April and the beginning of May, the Census Bureau will send out census takers. I shouldn't say that even. It's census takers, people they've hired to take the census. They take them, send them out the end of April, beginning of May, to go door to door, knock, and try and find the people who live at the addresses who have not responded. So it, you know, as you, I'm sure you understand that this is very much in our interest to have a large turnout. And historically, there have been certain populations that have been undercounted, and one of them is students. And Cornell and the colleges that have students living on campus have a particular problem because, of course, they do not have individual addresses. Those are considered sort of group residences. But so the Census Bureau doesn't have an address for them. They have an address for the students who live in College Town, but they don't have the student an address for the... So that is a very special problem for the people who are in your... Oh, you're not in that area anymore. I keep forgetting you. You're not in that district. So it's just trying to figure out the people who will have barriers to filling out these forms, whether it's language, whether it's cultural, whether it's fear, whatever the reason is, we're trying to figure out the ways that we can help them overcome those barriers so that they will fill out the forms. And of course, it's different strategies for different groups. Students, it's mostly just educating them that they need to fill it out here, not when they get home. It's not going to happen at home. That they need to fill it out while they're in Tompkins County.
Okay, we will get our... We'll learn more about this. And maybe, Marcia, February 2nd, the legislature meeting, you can be the first department head staff presentation, if you're ready. But we'll hear more about it, and it would involve everybody in the community as much as possible.
Well, could I just say, Martha, is that if people really, and I think would really suggest that people go to the website for the Census Bureau. It's www.uscensus.gov, and going there, you'll be able to look at the sample. There are 10 question sample in there. There's a ton of information, and I think it might help everybody understand if they do that.
Thank you, Pam. I've got Brian and then Kathy.
I've just got a question. In looking at that map, in terms of real numbers, if we were only 1,500 short before, and if Jim could hold up his end of the bargain in the village of Trumansbury, that would probably take care of it. But of the shaded areas that need some work, how many folks are we talking about? Do you have an idea in numbers? Because we're not very far off, it doesn't sound like.
Right. Offhand, no. I don't know.
Is it hundreds? Is it a few thousand?
Well, I mean, if the assumption is that there are about 100,000 people, you know, got to 100,000, it wouldn't take that much. But the actual part of it is just counting people. We don't know.
Okay.
Because they weren't counted. I think that from the addresses they sent out, this was the response rate that they got. It was lower. This response rate doesn't necessarily reflect always the number of people or the number of addresses out there. And one thing this time, it's very different than the last time, is thanks to our enhanced 911 system and to the efforts of ITS, they've done this amazing job in conjunction with all of the municipalities in the county of coming up with the most accurate list of addresses that you can. I mean, it's a very, very carefully done program that they put through, and they did it also in conjunction with the Census Bureau. So there's some real solid work that's been done this time.
Just a quick follow-up. You mentioned your foot soldiers, which I got an idea what that is, but these students are going to leave the end of May,
right,
and so forth, so that group would have to be gotten to
that's right.
rather quickly
that's right.
before they leave.
That's exactly right. That's the critical piece. That's really important.
Okay. Boy, this is a popular one. I would just say the actual count, I think, was 96,801, so it's about 3,200 shy of the mark. I've got Kathy, Leslyn, Pat. Is that right? Okay.
Thank you. One of the reasons this is so exciting is that, unlike 10 years ago, we've got, as Pam mentioned, a lot of electronic assistance to be able to not only enhance our count, but to be able to encourage us as we get toward that surge. It's a short term, and there's already national groups that are working hard to mobilize their constituency. There's Latino groups, which is one of the consistently underrepresented groups. There's groups that are going after the elderly to make sure that because of demographic shifts, even those maps, which were a couple of years old, I think, might, because of nodal development and other things, have shifted slightly. But we can track this stuff. So it's really exciting, and I take heart by what Carol started out saying, which is, we can't do this all, and ended up saying, but let's try. And I think that's the spirit we all want to go after this with, whether it means having a party at your local tavern or calling people together to your cafe and saying 10 questions. Have you got yours? Have you got any trouble with it? Do you have any questions? And just reminding people about it, and the awareness of it will increase and is going to cross all the boundaries, because we've got a lot at stake. CDBG block grants, as somebody mentioned, congressional seats, and our community, especially in this time, really needs to pull together on this one.
Leslyn.
She takes everything I want to say.
But I don't know the
thanks, Kathy. I just want to make sure that I got this right. You said, Marcia, you are organizing with the Census Committee a public information campaign around getting your forms filled out, sent in, etc., etc. So if we have thoughts or comments or others may do, we direct them to Marcia.
Marcia, do you want to say anything? You don't have to. But
where do they go?
Well, or me. I mean, and I'm going to go to that meeting that they're having. So
cool beans. I just need to know who they go to.
Do you want to add anything, Marcia?
We are working in conjunction with the Census Committee. This process is just starting right now. We have an awful lot to do in a very limited period of time. So we do need all your help. We need all your support. We need your ideas. So feel free to get in touch with me via phone, via email, and we will keep you posted. And the Public Information Advisory Board is very motivated and excited to help out with this.
Thank you very much. And Pat.
Yes. I just wondered, another logistical kind of question. I think we all know how important it is that we get this count, but for people who might not be as familiar with its importance, a couple reasons have been mentioned here tonight. The congressional seats, the CDBC block grants, and we know that there are other things. Is there someplace a synopsis, a brief synopsis of some of the kinds of things that, based on these census figures, it would make a real difference to the county in how important it is that we get a complete count?
No. I mean, in the information at the Census Bureau website, they have a list of 50 reasons why the census is very critical. But if you're asking specifically reasons for why it's critical for the county, we do not have a list. And I think that's a very good idea. Would you like to make it?
I guess I'll pass that on to the committee as a suggestion.
All right. Thank you very much, Pam, and everybody. A lot of enthusiasm, and we are going to do whatever we can to help.
Great.
All right, Budget and Capital, Jim.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Our three resolutions were passed under the consent agenda that we met before. We have, as you mentioned in your address, we had much to do in 2010, and we will do our very best, the committee and the legislature, to accomplish the things with the county administrator and the staff. And that concludes my report.
Thank you very much, Jim. Public safety, why don't you go right into that as...
Thank you. The Public Safety Committee, we have... these were all passed under...
No.
Not M?
No. No. JKL and M are all to still be considered.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And we need short form roll call on the first three. But,
okay. Let me move J, which is appropriation from contingent fund replacement pay sheriff's office road patrol. And I would move that $14,382 with the changes that were in your red folders, adding the word more, and for those days exceeding the 2 months. That's J.
Seconded by Carol. Is that right? Okay. Any questions? All right, roll call.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Would anyone like to be recorded as no? It passes unanimously.
Madam Chair.
Frank.
Just a question. Jim, you said there were changes that were in our red folders?
I believe so.
I don't.
They're not all there? I'm sorry. All right.
Can you say what they are?
Yeah, I did. In the first line of the resolution, the word greater was crossed out, more was put in, and then after contingent fund in the second whereas, the words for those days exceeding the 2 months.
We're going to have a new policy here where the legislature office's budget is seriously constrained. We're going to try to trim down the number of copies we make for every kind of resolution. So, in fact, Kathy and I have talked about perhaps having projection of resolutions that have been amended, especially where there's not really a felt need for full hard copies for everybody, for all the folders here. So I think that works. If there are relatively minor wording changes, we will make a judgment about which will go into the red folder only, but then the chair can read aloud those changes. Kathy?
Some of us may have a problem with that. There's developmental issues, there's comprehension issues. It might be not really accommodating all the needs of the legislature.
Well, perhaps the GO committee could take that up and try to tackle the issue of how to reduce the use of paper on things where we might be able to trim down. So there may be different ways to do it. Maybe some people could request to have all those resolutions in their folder. Do you want to say something, Mike?
We'd be glad to have a discussion about that.
Okay. Thank you very much. So that's why Jim had it, but everybody else didn't. Okay. You're on K.
Not having been as familiar with the new policy as I should have.
That's right.
I apologize. I'll move Resolution K.
Wait, can we vote?
Which, again, is appropriation from contingent fund, terminal pay reimbursement, sheriff's office, jail, $189. And that there is no change to that resolution.
Is there a second?
From the one you have in the folder.
Pat seconds. Short form roll call.
Ms. Jack?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Would anyone like to be recorded as no? That's unanimous.
And Resolution L, which is appropriation from the contingent fund replacement pay sheriff's office jail. And the numbers are in the resolution. This one, the word greater is deleted, more is added. And after contingent fund, second whereas, for those days exceeding the 2 months, and I would move that resolution.
And less than seconds. Short form roll call.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Anyone like to be recorded as no? That's unanimous. Thank you. And last
Resolution M, approval of amended bylaws, emergency communications review and oversight committee. And I would move that.
Second by Carol. All right, Dooley.
I just have a comment about the version that we have in our packet, the bylaws changes. They do not include strikeouts and new words the way I have grown used to seeing them. But the resolution itself makes clear what the changes are. And I'm not sure if it's the new IQM2 system that is responsible for the format of the bylaws or whether this is an anomaly. So I don't know whether staff can answer.
I'm looking around. Does anybody have an answer to that?
Well, it can wait.
The resolution came the way you see it to public safety.
The resolution is fine. It's right. The attachment.
With the attachment. That's all we got.
Is the problem for me.
Okay. That's how it came in from the committee.
From the department.
From the department.
Okay. It's moved.
Been moved. And there's somebody seconded, I think.
Carol.
Okay. Ready to vote? All in favor of the resolution? Aye. Please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thanks very much. Anything else, Jim?
A couple quick things. The committee met last week and passed these resolutions. Sheriff was there, spoke of the board outs and the diminished cost because of the new variances. Sheriff and the department will have to reapply to continue those. It clearly cut the cost of board outs for us with those variances. Sean Martel Moore was there speaking about the AED program that we have, which is the DFIP program leftover that Greg Stevenson was so supportive of when he was here. 60 staff will be trained for the use of these instruments, and hopefully they'll be installed soon in all the buildings of the county. There was a discussion by Pat Bouchel of the SCRAM devices, which are the ankle bracelets for people who have been arrested for, I believe, DWI. And there's been some problem with reading them with the computer system, and people are working on that. And the final thing that we did was the interim supervising attorney appointment that you all voted on earlier. And there was a discussion of the goals, and the new chair of the committee will have to then continue those as the year goes on. And if there are no questions, that was the extended meeting.
Frank?
Jim, if you'd permit me, I neglected, these can come under public safety. I neglected to mention two items under the health committee that could also be listed under emergency items, if you'd allow me to do that.
Absolutely.
Alice and Brenda reported that there will be additional H1N1 clinics because they have now received an abundance of material.
Vaccine.
The vaccine is abundant, both nasal as well as the shots. And they're being scheduled now. If you need an appointment, the health department is a site at this time, and there'll be other sites in the community. The number that we were given was that over 6,000 inoculations have already been given, and all the school districts are done. The second item has to do with pharmaceutical material. A lot of folks have been asking, what do I do with old meds and my old sharps, because there's no way to dispose of them. You can't flush them down. You shouldn't be flushing them down the toilet. I wanted, and I'm sorry I neglected to report this under my own committee, on March the 6th, there will be a pharmaceutical day, March 6th, at TCAT, at the facility down on Willow Ave from 10 until 2. That's the time that we've been given. It may change slightly, and it will be monitored. Anyone that has old medication, old needles that they want to dispose of can bring them down there and turn them in. And in that way, we can keep them out of the waste stream and also out of the hands of people that probably shouldn't be accessing them through a dumpster or something along those lines. Let me say that date again. And Marsha is probably going to do some sort of a news item on this. I think we spoke about it briefly. March the 6th from 10 until 2 at the TCAT facility. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Frank.
That's another bite of the apple, as you like to say. All right. Anything else for Jim?
No, thank you. That concludes the public safety report.
Thank you very much. We can have the motion on the minutes of the previous meeting, January 5th. Jim moves, Pam seconds. Any comments or suggestions? All in favor of the minutes. Raise your hand, please. In your packets. Any opposed? Mm-hmm. That's any opposed?
I still got my hand up on the eye.
Okay. That's unanimous. Thank you very much. Jerry and Steve, you've been waiting. Very happy that you're here. I would... Could we do, I mean, really a five-minute break? Just 5 minutes? Do we need that, or would people like to just go ahead?
No, we need a break.
I'm sorry.
Break.
Yeah,
break.
All right. Yeah. Just a five-minute break. I think Joe has a handout as well. We'll put it onto your desks. And be right back at 20 up. Thank you.
Yeah, it's not good. All right.
Take your seats, please. All right, I wanted to let you know that the you've got a handout on your tables now. That's from Jerry, from Joe, I'm sorry. And the way we'd like to do this is, first I'd like to introduce Jerry Goodenow, from the plant manager from AES Cayuga. And he'll talk about the plant itself and about a little bit about the business at the plant. And things that happened in since we signed the original pilot, and that's why we're here tonight. Joe will go through kind of what the revised pilot means and a bit about the negotiation process. And Steve Witcher, as I said earlier, the county administrator, previous county administrator and director of assessment, so sort of dual talents here that have really been tremendously helpful. Steve's been volunteering as the as part of the negotiating team since, I think, 2007, something like that. So so we'd like to go through these presentations, and if you wouldn't mind, write your questions down as we go along, rather than popping hands up. I think it may help to kind of go through the whole topic and have people sort of just listen to everything, and your questions may get answered during the discussion. And obviously, there will be plenty of time for questions at the end. So, with that, Jerry, come on up to the mic, to the microphone. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks for waiting for us.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of the board this evening. I do recognize quite a few of the faces. I'm a self-admitted Channel 16 junkie.
There's a group for that.
My TV is between ESPN and Channel 16. So.
What's more entertaining?
Vikings. Okay. I just want to give a brief background of my history of the business. I think you probably want to hear more from Joe and Steve. Thanks for volunteering, by the way. I'm born and raised in upstate New York, lived here all my life, Ithaca College graduate, still bleed bomber blue, moved to Tompkins County in 1992. I started with NYSEG in 1988 down in Binghamton, general offices, engineering department down there, moved up to then Milliken Station in 92, stayed with the business. When the PSC asked utilities to divest their generation portfolio, I was a transferred employee into AES in 1999. I became a plant manager in 2001. A leadership role I take very, very seriously. I understand the commitment that this business has made to communities. First off, for the delivery of safe, clean, reliable energy. Second, the commitment for reliable jobs, for safe jobs. Third, the commitment for a corporate citizen. I'm pretty involved around in the community, and quite a few of our employees are. And then fourth, of course, is the role of a taxpayer. There's been a few stakeholders that I just mentioned, the school, the town, the county, the IDA, who over 2 years have gotten together and formed a committee. They've developed a process. A very good process through data exchange, some very good communication. An evaluation model was built. A lot of hard work, but I very much appreciate the efforts that have gone into doing that. The business went through some pretty major changes in 99. Two big ones. First bought by AES, which is a huge, huge company. But their business plan, their business model is when they come in to an organization or when they come in a community and buy a business, it's run locally. Every business they own is an LLC. They're in 23 countries worldwide. They're all LLCs. It's run locally. The second change that was fairly subtle to the public, but I think most of you are aware of it now, is that this is not a utility. It's a merchant power business. We compete with every generator in New York State for the delivery of our product. We offer our product daily into the New York ISO market. So every generator out there we're competing with. In 2009, last year, our business, just like every other business, was hit with some pretty severe economic times. The demand for energy was an all-time low. You can see that on, if you go onto the New York ISO sites, you will see that winter and summer peak was off, extremely off. Our business, one of the measurements of our business is capacity factor. And you'll hear that word used quite a lot tonight, probably from Joe and Steve. That's an input to this model that was developed. But capacity factor is simply a measurement of how much product you sell. It's a percentage, and it's the energy that we actually sold divided by the amount of energy we could have sold. It's a pretty simple formula. And we're typically, we've been in business for since 1955, over 50 years. As far back as I can find, we've typically been around an 85-88% type capacity factor, very base load. Last year we were 61% capacity factor. That's 25% off. Also last year, and there's been a lot of talk about this at this working committee level, was the first year that a regulation, it's not really a piece of legislation, it's a regulation that was put in by seven states in the Northeast. It's called, it's got the acronym REGI, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And that's basically a CO2 tax. And that hit us up last year for an additional $4 million. It's not recoverable in the market. So how did we react to that? Well, like every business did, we cut back on our O&M. We had about a 15% reduction in O&M. We went from 95 employees down to 76. That's about a 13% reduction. And all capital projects were ceased, with the exception of anything that had to do with safety or environmental. I formed a small committee that oversaw those projects, and I chaired that committee, so not too many projects got through. I've continued that business model
looking forward. Some of the things that we see on the horizon that are very visible is future federal regulations coming down the pipe. They're going to layer more costs onto the business, costs that are really tough to find how they're going to be recovered in today's market. Again, as a merchant, I've heard some folks, even as recent as a couple months ago, say, well, you know, what's the big deal? Why don't you just go in front of the PSC and adjust your rate? Well, I don't have that opportunity. The only way I can adjust anything is to offer my product differently in the market, and then you won't get accepted. And we were off last year for 5 weeks on one of the units, and for 10 complete days, the plant was actually black, neither unit running. And that's the first in history that we've ever been off for economics. So I'm just trying to give a little background. What's going to happen down the road? Well, this is a very difficult business to do forecasting with. We model as best as we can, but I do have some pretty big concerns. It's a capital intense business. For those who have visited the plant, you can see that there's a lot of equipment out there and a very high capital structure. It demands a 1 year, a 5 year, and a 10 year plan. We have those plans in place, and we have for as long as I've run the business. However, what we've seen lately in the last 12 to 18 months, on my leadership team, we've gone to 3 month and 6 month plans. And it's really tough to sustain with this business. That coupled with the fact that New York State continues to disregard communities, local communities, and industry by just adding layers on top of these costs and adding more fees. We've all seen the mandated fees. With the continued depressed energy market, I haven't seen the market move a whole lot. We saw some energy movement first couple months of January when the weather got severe, but even the last couple of days, the energy markets come back off. It really is making running this business challenging. So, it's very difficult for me, because I'm a very positive person, to try to explain, but in reality, this is the conditions we're under. Now, the bright side of this is that we were able to sit down with the school, with the county, with the town, and with the IDA, and I think we've developed a model process for New York. I don't know of any other business that evaluates, any other power plant that evaluates their business the way we do. I think it's a very good model. We've been able to trim the fat from this process, which you would do if you were running a business, without any direct shot at any attorneys in the room. We've been able to get the attorneys out of the room. We've been able to get the appraisers out of the room, and we've been able to sit down and figure this out on our own. Very open communication. We've got some pretty good guidelines on how we're going to conduct business. A lot of the data is available publicly. Price of fuel, the price of energy. So we've sat down and we've developed a pretty good process. You'll hear a lot of explanation of how that works from Joe and Steve tonight. But, I appreciate the committee's efforts on that. And I think Martha said hold your questions till the end. I wanted to be brief, but I'll stick around, and if I can, I'll answer any questions that you get. I would like to offer. Will and Pat were at the plant yesterday, and I hope you enjoyed your tour, and I'd like to offer that to anybody who would like to come and tour. Work that through Martha, and she can get a hold of me, and we'll have you come in. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jerry. And I just want to also mention Michael Stamm from the IDA would have been here tonight, but he's in Albany, so just because this is an IDA project, so we tried to get him here, but he couldn't. Joe, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks. First, let me explain what you have in front of you, the two or three-page document. For those of you who have heard me over the past year or so, it's probably hard to believe, but when I present things to you, I usually outline my remarks and speak from an outline. As I prepared to do that tonight and shared it with the group to make sure I had all these things right, we really thought it might be helpful for you to have kind of my own notes to myself in front of you to help, because we're going to go through some things that aren't that complex, but it might help to have something in writing in front of you to consult with as I'm talking. And it might also, over the next couple of weeks, when this is going to be out there and waiting to come back to the legislature, it might also provoke questions that you may have about the payment in lieu of tax, the modification of the pilot agreement that that is currently on the table. I do want to acknowledge Steve Witcher, and there will be parts in here perhaps where I'll ask Steve for some help, and at the end he can go through some of the more complicated valuation issues that are a part of what we're talking about tonight. Let me start with just kind of some foundation information about background here and how we came to have a pilot. And for those of you who don't know, PILOT is an acronym. It stands for Payment in Lieu of Tax. And historically, there has been a tax. There has been a taxable assessment placed on this plant that over the years has been very volatile, very difficult to determine, and very contentious. Often the assignment of value to this plant has ended up being resolved either in the courts or as a part of a process of challenging that assessment in the legal arena. And to the credit of this community, and this began back, I don't know, Steve, 2006, 2007, there was a decision made that there has to be a better way to deal with the taxation of this large facility in our county than to keep going through this very contentious, litigious process. And the party sat down at that time and began to talk about a payment in lieu of tax agreement that would better govern the way these taxes are managed, create a common base of understanding about how the taxes are going to be determined, and have a process in place that leads to stability that hasn't existed before. So those were really the elements that the parties tried to achieve through the creation of a payment in lieu of tax agreement, and I think accomplished that in the form of an agreement that was approved in February 2009 by the IDA. Just a couple of things that I'd like you to keep in mind as we go through this presentation. First of all, we'll talk about the income of the plant and market value and so forth. Just as we talk about the assessed value, the underlying value in this pilot, it is based on an underlying sense of market value. And in the case of these plants and commercial properties, market value is obviously what somebody would pay for a property. And in the case of plants, that's based on how much net income that property can produce for its owners. The state says you can't do the cost basis of appraisal. You can't look at how much it would cost to build a new plant, depreciate it, and arrive at it that way. It needs to be based either on an income approach, and it looks at the net income produced by this facility, or the market approach, which means comparing sales of like facilities. There aren't really sales of like facilities. So you come back to an income approach. So that's why we will be talking about the income situation at the plant throughout this conversation. And the last thing to keep in mind, just again for background information, we will talk about the assessed value, the underlying value in 2010. Understand that means it will affect school taxes in 2010 and county and town taxes in 2011. There's a lag factor when it comes to the tax impact of those values in the schedule. So if we could just spend a minute or two talking about the, let's call it the original pilot, the one that was approved back in February of 2009. It was the product of negotiations that occurred over a period of 2 years. And the centerpiece of those negotiations was a model that was developed by Steve Witcher that helped guide the estimate of valuation for the plant. Now, when we say that Steve did it, it's not because Steve was my predecessor as county administrator. Steve is an appraiser by training and by education and did complex appraisals for the state of New York for a significant part of his career. So Steve knows. And Steve put together a model that, again, both parties could agree was a good way of estimating the value of that facility. It used several significant factors that relate to the income of the facility and therefore the market value of that plant. The primary elements in there on income and expense, on the expense side, the cost of fuel, coal, and the cost to transport that coal to the facility. Those are really the major expenses in the plant's budget. On the revenue side, how much energy is expected to be sold? You know, the vocabulary of the plant is capacity factor. That's one way of getting to the point of how much energy is that plant selling or can it be expected to sell given its market conditions. The third element is obviously the cost of that energy that is sold. And it's the cost that the market is willing to pay for energy produced by that facility. And its technical thing is bought by the New York State Independent System Operator. There's an acronym for that, too. But basically, it's the price the market is willing to pay for energy produced at the facility. So those are really the drivers of the net income situation at the plant, the cost and transportation of fuel, how much energy is sold, and at what price. And based on those conditions, and there are other things in that formula that come into play, but based largely on that beginning point of net income, when that original pilot was put together, based on the conditions of that time, there was an agreement that the plant had an underlying value of about $255 million. It was the ultimate value. And that compared to where the value was currently at that point. The assessed value was at $140 million. So there was an agreement made through this pilot to transition from where the assessment was at $140 million to where it would be based on those conditions of $255 million, and basically to spread that growth almost equally over a period of 5 years. So five increments to get from the old value to the new value. And that basically set the pattern for the balance of the pilot. The pilot is broken up into five-year blocks. So just like in that first block of time, it took 5 years to go from the start to the finish on the assessment. Then you go to the next block of 5 years. And there's a discussion about what the underlying value would be during that next five-year period. If it's different than where you left it before, there's a five-year transition at that point. That's the basic kind of arithmetic of the way this schedule was to work. It allowed for gradual change to replace the volatility that had existed before. It allowed for some stability that didn't exist before. Now, that said, everybody around that table knew that there were uncertainties involved in that equation, that any one of those variables might change given what was happening in the market, given regulatory changes, given legislative changes, and so forth. There was an agreement that things might be different as time went on. So there were steps put into the agreement that allowed for a revisiting of what those values were. And I'll go through those in just a second. In fact, I'll go to those right now. If you look at the section on page 2 that's captioned Pilot Review and Opportunities to Adapt to Change, that's what we're talking about. So again, with level-headed people sitting around the table, they realized that things could change. So what do you do? How do you make this document adjust to changing times? Well, there were a couple of things that were put in this agreement. The first is there's an obligation to get together every year in the summertime to look at what the conditions are and to get a sense, are they going the way we had thought or not? And if they're different, to kind of ensure that we understand that and we're aware that there might be changes coming so there are no surprises. People can begin to plan. And that's an annual part of the process that was put in place. But there's also an opportunity where if conditions warrant, there can be modifications to the pilot. The first one in the agreement says that there's what's called an adjustment period, and it's one adjustment period. And with notice, very early in each five-year block, either party can say, we want to revisit that underlying value of this plant. We want to revisit that kind of baseline value in that five-year period. And time will be taken to look at that. And if there's an agreement to change it, then the last 3 years of the five-year block is used as the phase-in period to either make that reduction in phases or allow the increase to occur in phases. So that's the adjustment period. That's what's laid out in the agreement. But then there's also an acknowledgement in the agreement that there can be extraordinary circumstances that don't follow a rigid timeline that can happen any time. And in the event of an extraordinary circumstance declared by either party, again, there would be a revisiting of the value to see if it should be changed. And if there's an agreement that it should be changed, that change would, again, be phased in over the remaining years of that five-year block. So that's the extraordinary circumstance situation. Now, If we came to these points and neither party could agree what the value should be, there's some other steps built in this agreement. One, we must go to a mediation, a neutral third party, to figure out what that underlying value should be, and we will yield to that group. Or if there's no, as a last resort, we can go to court. We can let the court declare a value. Now, what we found to date is that we have been able to get together and in good faith talk about the situation and come to what we all believe on the negotiating team to be a reasonable response to some extraordinary situations that have happened recently. And if I could go to the session the revised pilot and talk about what has happened over the past few months in light of the conditions that Jerry just described. Last spring, AES informally let the county know that the recession was having a significant impact on its status, and that because of a very rapid decline in demand, low natural gas prices, which compete for this, other conditions in the market, there was a concern that we would have to invoke the extraordinary circumstance clause. By summer, that advisory had become a formal request to come back to the table because of the extraordinary circumstances that were affecting the net income of the plant. AES requested that we sit down and we review the pilot in light of those changes. So the county's team came back together. The negotiating team consisted of Martha Dooley, Mike Kaplink-Allaire, Michael Stamm from TCAD, myself. And we did bring Steve Witcher back because of the continuity factor and his knowledge in appraisals. We also invited representatives of the town of Lansing and the Lansing School District to join us. They were invited to all the sessions. They attended several. The first session was to make sure we understood what the changes of conditions were. And to its credit, AES opened up its books. This is a corporate citizen that is... absolutely, we use the word transparency a lot in terms of our discussions with them, absolutely good faith and transparent in its presentation of facts. When we looked at those key factors that affect value, we found, first of all, that there was no evidence in the numbers that anything that was happening in that plant was the responsibility, the fault of AES. This isn't a matter of bad management or mishandling a difficult situation. The stresses of the plant relate to an economy that melted down and demand that fell very abruptly. Its revenues declined, and its expenses, interestingly, really didn't reduce to the amount that you might think. The price of coal, for example, remember that's one of its largest expenses, hasn't gone down. It's gone down, it's almost imperceptible, and it's because there's a global demand for coal. So it can't be sold here, can be sold abroad, and it's kept the price of coal up. So as we looked at the net operating income, which is revenues less expenses, and looked at those conditions, and again, you'll see here there are other factors too that Jerry talked about, a new environmental tax, the new legislation that affected the price of operations. Net operating income at the plant had declined rather significantly. So in that declining net operating income, there was also a decline of market value. After that finding, we did agree to sit with AES and negotiate a new value. And we did that between July and November. I think we had four meetings over the course of that period to settle on a final value and then to figure out a transition plan to get from where we were to where that ultimate value was. Over the course of that process, we agreed ultimately to an underlying value of a baseline value of $100 million. Now that compares to the $255 million value that was expected in that original pilot. That's how drastically the conditions had changed and the market had changed for that plant. And in the transition from where we were and the current underlying assessment, the thing that the payment in lieu of tax is based on right now, is $160 million. So the transition was from $160 million currently down to that $100 million ultimate value, and I've shown in the handout how that schedule works. It's a bit front-loaded. The largest increase occurs in the first year, and that's clearly a reflection of the very difficult situation that the plant faces right now. It then scales down in $10 million increments for the balance of that plan to get down to $100 million at the end of the line. The impact of these changes is significant in terms of tax revenue. And you can see on the chart that's included here, the taxes that would be generated for the school, county, town, and fire district under a $160 million kind of basis for the pilot, and what that would be if it was $130 million in next year. And you can see that the effect on taxes between us all is about $793,000. Significant change. At the same time, our focus really has to be on what is the market value and what's the fair way to assess the plant. And I think all of us on the team agree that this is the appropriate approach to take. I guess in closing, just to add a couple of things, and they're probably editorial as opposed to arithmetic, as we've talked about before. There was a part of my life when I did economic development, and I've been exposed to a lot of companies and corporations. I will tell you that AES Cayuga is an extraordinary corporate citizen, and I'm not exaggerating when I say absolutely transparent in their dealings with the county. A very good faith effort. Their facilities include underutilized land and infrastructure right now that might lend itself to development that could occur around there, and I think we need to think about the future as well. And the plant currently is the largest single private taxpayer in the county at $160 million. It will still be the second highest taxpayer in the county even after this adjustment. And a distant third is, I think, NYSEG right now is in second. Cornell Taxable Properties is third. So even after all these adjustments, this facility will be the second largest taxpayer in the county. So that's, I guess, I don't want to say the long and short of it because it was kind of long, but that's where we are.
Thank you very much, Joe. That was very helpful. Steve. I know, Peter, it feels so unnatural not to have questions in the middle, but I feel like bear with us, and we'll get to that.
I'll keep it really short. I think my role here is more just to reiterate what was said and give you a little bit of history because there's some parts that are missing there. But just to back up what Joe just said, AES is probably the most responsible corporate citizen I've ever dealt with, and that's as an assessor and as a county administrator working for you. They are extraordinary, and they always approached everything with a very forthright approach. I checked every piece of data they ever submitted. I checked and double-checked. I never found anything misleading in anything they ever said. So I find them very, very, very trustworthy. One thing that was we didn't mention is just going back a little bit further in history and why the county actually entered into this process. AES purchased the property in 99. I was the assessor at that time. We had negotiations on how do we handle a market approach to valuing a income generating or electric generating property, which no one really had a model in the state of New York. So both parties agreed to hire the best appraisers that we knew of. I happened to have a lot of contacts in the industry at the time, and we hired a firm out of Chicago who were, I think, the best appraisers in the country. We spent about $50,000 on that appraisal. AES did exactly the same thing. They hired KPMG. I think that's the right name. Anyway, they hired a very, very fine appraisal company also. Both parties agreed that we would not instruct our appraisers to come up with the value that fits our needs the best, but rather to really try to value the property the best they possibly could. What was interesting, and I think Dula can back me up on this, was when the appraisals came in, and we did not have any way of knowing what the values were going to be when they came in, but when they did come in, and they were just exchanged across the table, they were incredibly close together. I mean, like 1%, maybe 2% apart. It was amazing. In those appraisals was the basis for the model that we've adopted in the pilot process. So Steve Witcher didn't invent this. You know, it's not my creation or anything else. I just happened to take the most extraordinary minds in the world and use their data and then claimed it for my own. So I like that. Worked really well for me. Also what happened at the same time was New York State passed legislation that said that we would move from valuing power plants from a cost approach, which is a fairly an accountant's approach to valuing a property, but it had nothing to do with the value of the property, nothing to do with its ability to generate income. When New York State decided to deregulate the industry and stop protecting the industries, that required a different approach for determining their ability to pay taxes. And that's why this happened. So that's a short history of it, and I can walk you through a lot more detail if you are ever interested in it, but I don't think you are. Let's see. The other thing I would add is that what's interesting about this whole change and the whole process that we're going through is that this really puts AES and power plants in the same situation as other taxpayers, in that they have an annual review. Their properties are looked at based on the value of the property, just like everybody else's property in the on the tax rolls. In the past, and I'm going back 10 years, the value of the property for a electric generating plant wasn't based on anything other than a mathematical calculation of how much it costs to put this bolt in here and that bolt in there. Add it all up, and then when you got all done with that whole process, and we're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars, then you calculated an exemption factor, which was plucked out of the air. So the whole process made no sense. So this process makes a lot more sense. It's more equitable. It's more responsive. And it also protects all parties, that allowing the stepped approach. When the market goes, when the value of the property went up, AES did not, you know, it was the first time we went through this process, there was a very substantial increase in the valuation of the power plant. AES just stepped up to the plate and said, yep, that's fine, that's exactly what, we'll accept that. We'd like to have more stability in how we approach that and have it step up. Always knowing that if the value of the plant dropped, it would have to step down also rather than change in 1 year. And that's what you're looking at right now. When the committee got together and looked at it, we really felt that what had happened in the last year was so extraordinary that the stepping down couldn't just be a smooth process. We had to be a little bit more aggressive. So I think that we did a very fine job. I thought everyone on the committee was extremely responsible and did a really, really fine job. I was proud to be part of this team. Okay?
Thank you very much, Steve. And I wanted to I get the first question, Steve. So the appraisal in 1999 was about $50,000 was the fee?
The assessed value in...
No, for the cost of the appraisal.
Oh, cost of the appraisal, yes, was around $50,000.
And today, an estimate, if we had to go to court and get an appraisal?
No, the appraisal itself, I think, would... be in the $75,000 to $80,000 range, and then once you start any kind of litigation, you'd be looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars without any question. And the process would take somewhere between 2 and 5 years, and you would have an extended liability out there that would end up in a very artificial value at the end, which would be extraordinarily low and would be very difficult for all taxing jurisdictions to deal with.
Thank you. And I wanted to point out that yesterday I sent you all by email, and if people need hard copies, the full agreement, the pilot, the payment in lieu of taxes agreement that was signed in February of last year. And I tried to answer the questions that had come up at PDEC about this. So so that's in your inboxes. If you don't also have a hard copy, you know, we could get you. So. Thank you all for your patience in asking questions. So start with Peter.
I find it hard to get my mind around this question, but I always thought of an appraisal of a property meant not how much money were you making out of this restaurant that you had on the property, but suppose you went broke or lost interest in doing this job, then presumably there's somebody else who you could sell the property to, maybe a lot of people you could sell the property to, but in the end, it probably wouldn't go vacant. And that sale would determine the value of the property. At least that's what I've always been told about the appraisal of my house. That's what that was about, was how much was someone willing to pay for this thing. So I assume that this plant would... something would happen to it, and it could be sold. And I have no idea how to figure that out, but I imagine there must be, on this globe, lots of sales of private power plants one way or the other. So that's one question I have. Why doesn't that concept work? And another question I had was, when I noticed this fantastic drop of a factor of 2.5 in the assessed value, does that mean that there was a drop of a factor of 2.5 of the kilowatt hours that were sold by this plant over that period of time or not? Mm-hmm. I had a third question. Oh, yeah, a third question is that if indeed somehow this is to be related to how much money it can make, isn't the right way of doing it just that? To say, instead of having a property tax, we'll have an income tax. We'll decide what is a fair fraction of the money that this place makes as a profit. Or another way of looking at it is some fraction of the price of kilowatt hours that they make, which would be a whole lot less negotiation, not very murky. And it wouldn't have to be renegotiated as time goes on. And what's more, it would be immediate. That instead of, I mean, this thing was undervalued a year ago by what it says here. It was. I haven't got it here. Where is it? The current value is 140 million. The current value is 255 million, mm-hmm. but it's now being assessed at 140 million. So that was off by about a factor of two. So we said, well, okay, we'll ramp it up over a 5-year period. But son of a gun, they weren't paying taxes on a $255 million. They were getting by with $150 million of value that they weren't paying taxes on at that point, and that never got paid. Okay, now it's dropped, and so we have a reassessment. So it seems to me that something that would be more immediate than a 5-year lag, namely just a direct linking to the, I hate to say it, but an income tax, okay? A direct linking to their profits or to their, okay, their sales.
Can I stop you there? Because otherwise I'm going to forget how many questions you have.
The first
three.
Okay. Let's just start with the appraisal. Your question was really related to, you know, why is the approach based on the income, and why is that dissimilar than a restaurant? A restaurant has two factors. One is a business factor that is part of... It's not a real property. That's a personal property. It's a business property. It has the building component. So the way you would value a restaurant for real property tax purposes is the rent that the restaurant would pay to the landlord. Okay? Just like with an apartment building. Okay, it's the same concept. You're calculating a net income. Okay? Give me the difference in the value, the assessed value. We said the property was valued. We were a little, I won't say loose with the language, but let me clarify a couple things. All the values we were talking about were the assessed values. The assessed values can be determined by the parties negotiating, by the assessor putting a value on, or by the court assigning a value. The value that was on the rolls prior to this pilot agreement was a result of litigation, and it was a value that was artificially low because there was a recovery period when the value was artificially high. Okay? So It's not that the property was undervalued before. It was valued in accordance with the court order. When we came to the table for the pilot, we were negotiating basically, I think it was about 5 or 6 years later than the court basis was done. So that's probably the extraordinary difference there. Now, what was the third question?
Third question is, why not an income tax if you like,
okay,
it based on income?
Income, it's a nice idea. It's actually, in concept, what's going on and being applied through the real property tax law. The issue really is that there is no basis in New York State law to do an income tax. That might be an interesting way to approach it. It might be simpler. I think if you look at most corporations and their ability to avoid paying income tax, I think that might not be the best solution in the end. The one thing that we do have is with the real property tax, we have a lot more control over what the value of the property is, and we have a lot better ability to negotiate in favor of the taxpayer.
And I think there was a question maybe for Jerry about the capacity factor. Peter, you might.
Yeah, I just wondered that big change, does that mean that there was that same big change in electricity that got sold?
Whatever you want to. Jerry can chime in, but what we were talking about in negotiating the value of the property was based on the net income. There are many factors that go into that net income. The capacity factor is one of them. In other words, how much do you actually generate? Jerry alluded to the fact that the coal prices did not drop as dramatically as other properties, as other components of the valuation process. For example, AES has to compete in the marketplace when they sell electricity with oil-fired plants, natural gas, hydro plants, nuclear plants. And one of the things we did check very carefully was AES came to the table and said, the price of electricity has dropped really dramatically. Well, I looked at my bill from the meeting from the month before, and I said to Jerry, I'm not seeing it. So show me how this is really true. I went into the marketplace, and indeed, and I did take a closer look at my bill, and I had a year-long contract, and I was paying very high prices. But the price of electricity has dropped very dramatically. And I'll let Jerry give the right number, but I think it's about half, maybe more than that.
Yeah, it was half at the time, and it's about 45% now. So it's seen about a 5% recovery.
I got variable rate. My bill doesn't change either. But.
Steve, I'd also, Frank just pointed out, there's also the issue in terms of valuing, there are no comparables. I mean, isn't that part of this?
There are two ways of approaching the valuation of the property. One is market and one is income. When AES purchased the property, they purchased five plants, I think it was, as a group. When we've looked at sales of properties throughout the United States, and when we hired appraisers, that's what happens. You can find comparables. I defy you to explain how the property was valued. There's just so many variables that go into how that number came up. And the number that gets reported, let's say it's $100 million. Well, what was tied in with that? Were there long-term contracts? Is there some sort of other elements involved? I mean, you heard Jerry say that he used to work for NYSEG and he transitioned. Well, and there was also, when AES bought it, there was, a five-year agreement of as to AES was going to be selling certain percentage of their electricity to NYSEG. I mean, there are lots of things that go into every sale that make the market a very, very difficult approach to valuing a property. The income approach is difficult enough with the risk factors involved, and it takes an extraordinary amount of time and patience to work through these valuation issues. But the market approach, I think, could. If you got into court trying to argue about the market value of an electric generating plant, I think you'd be there for the rest of your life.
Brian.
Thank you. First off, I can appreciate, although I can't appreciate how this process works. I only know that I'm sure that the good faith efforts are designed to to keep this company viable and to collect whatever taxes that that we can and keep the same jobs that we have. My question that I had written down was, are we setting ourselves up for, and I guess I would change that to, can we expect similar pilot arrangements for other manufacturing or other manufacturers during the present and or future recessionary times? Again, all tied to their sales, the ebbs and flows of the business. I'm just curious to that, because if that's going to be the case, we're going to tie up a lot of folks.
Yeah,
in that process.
The county was willing to enter into this and to bring it forward to the IDA for one other reason that I hadn't mentioned yet, and thank you for bringing this up. There's something called an equalization process, and Mike remembers this, I'm sure. Those of you who go back before Tompkins County had a 100% market values for assessed values, every year you had to pass a resolution saying you agreed with the equalized values of the municipalities. Well, the state of New York equalizes all values in the state of New York. And so every county, every town, every school district, every district gets valued. Part of that process is to look at a sampling of the assessor's role. If there is a parcel that is large enough to be called very uniquely a large parcel, then it's automatically always selected. This parcel was considered a large parcel, obviously, because it's a very large parcel in Tompkins County. The county, AES, and the Office of Real Property Services, which does the equalization process, did not agree as to the valuation methodology. I worked for the Office of Real Property Services for many years. I am very, very familiar with their process. I'm very familiar with the people who are doing the work. They're very good friends of mine. I had lots of discussions with them about their approach. The bottom line was they were valuing the property extraordinarily highly. And I said, I just don't understand how you can possibly justify these values. And we walked through every detail, and I still couldn't justify the values in my mind. And I finally came to the conclusion they were really trying to push the counties into the position of trying to form the IDAs and approach the values that way, to take it out of the process. So, and I think that's a fair assessment of what was going on, a fair evaluation of what was going on. So it was to the county's benefit to not have the power plant on the roll, and so therefore we were strongly motivated to make that change to support the pilot approach. With other large parcels, manufacturing industries and so on, they're much easier to value. There's more of a market. It's not that difficult. Their business cycles change. Their rent values of the properties don't tend to change that rapidly. Okay, so there's a smoother process with them. And I think they do feel fairly treated. But you have to be careful, just like with the restaurant example, not to confuse the business value and the building value.
I saw Mike.
If AES decides to sell Milliken, is there a reopener that we can look at it with the sale value?
We can. Either party can open the process up due to extraordinary circumstances. And if AES were to sell AES Cayuga for an extraordinary amount of money, we would. I'm sure the negotiating party would invoke that clause. What I think the industry is looking at right now is a public policy that is saying that it's very questionable as to whether or not the public will support a coal-fired plant anywhere in the world, and this is a public policy that's being implemented at a local level, and you're seeing it firsthand, and this is what happens. And that's the bottom line of it.
Carol.
Yeah, I want to thank, you know, all of you who've been involved in this, because it does sound like you've done an awful lot of work, you know, AES, from AES to the negotiating team to Steve to everybody who's been involved. And, I hear the pain that, you know, that you're going through now, and certainly we all know that the market has been through such a huge upheaval, and the level of uncertainty that there is sort of on both sides right now seems huge. We don't know, you don't know what will happen, you don't know what the prices will be. They've changed drastically since a year ago, less than a year ago. And none of us know what's going to happen with other forms of fuel. There's just so much that I'm not sure we can know 4 years into the future. And that's my concern. I do still have a concern that the public is being asked to share the pain of the bad years here without enough of a stipulation that we'll be able to share, that we're sure we'll be able to share the joys of the good years if things do look up. And given the level of uncertainty there's been and the change in less than a year, who knows where it's going to go. I did do my homework very thoroughly. I have the whole document. I've been through it twice. I do see that things like this agreement will convey. I mean, AES and Jerry have been incredible in this negotiation, but this whole agreement conveys if it gets sold or if some other multinational corporation comes in and wants a different way of doing business with you. I would feel more comfortable. Others might not be as transparent. Who knows what the EPA is going to do about all kinds of regulations? I mean, it could go either way. So I would feel more comfortable if we had things like certainly an annual report from the negotiating committee to this body. I heard different things here than I saw in the agreement between the annual reopening. It seemed to be that if neither party asks for it, we can go 5 years without a reopener. But one of you referred to an annual reopener. And I don't have any problems with the values that we're changing for the next 2 years. I have some more problems with, you know, as Peter raised, for the degree to which the numbers are changing afterwards. So I would feel more comfortable if there were some kind of trigger, or whatever else you want to call it, that says, okay, the public will share the pain now, but rather than have to come back and double the amount if times get good, here's something that will automatically kick in a need to have these numbers go back up that will also convey if something happens in terms of the current management of the plant.
I think it certainly is perhaps the confusion about the annual reopener. There's an annual sit-down meeting where we will update, you know, get an update on the plant's operations, on the economy, on everything. And that is built into the agreement. It's certainly an easy thing and a good idea to, after that, for the negotiating team to come back to the full legislature or to the relevant committee and give an update. That's not hard. David.
Sure.
I think this is a good teaching point. But if you look at this thing right here, the back on the taxes, on page 4, the tax liability among the various parties. But I just want to make sure you understand something. The county guarantees taxes to municipalities, and were a large taxpayer like this not to pay the taxes, the county would be paying the school district that figure on the school line. It would be paying the town that figure. and we'd be out the same amount that we budget, we presume, is paid. So you have to take that kind of thing, the willingness to pay, also into effect. We got into trouble with a nursing home that didn't pay their taxes, and we guaranteed taxes of hundreds of thousands of dollars to the municipalities that we still haven't recovered. So that's why you want to negotiate things, because we're on the hook whether or not anything happens.
So you're saying that instead of just looking at what they're not going to pay, look at what they are going to pay.
Yes.
That's a good point. Let me just also, okay, I got Brian, Dave, you're next, I think, right? Let me finish about the, I think it was a couple of emails ago, I also sent you a copy of the letter that I wrote to Jerry from on the IDA stationery, and that talks, it sort of summarizes the agreement, the revision of the agreement, and in there we say, as part of our understanding, it's acknowledged that this agreement will be revised next year, meaning 2010, as is provided in the agreement. I wrote this at the end of last year, that we, when you talk about 4 years, we already have agreed that we will come together later this year, probably late spring, and start looking at the market again, looking at the process again. So we had to put all the 4 years worth of numbers in here. But basically, the relevant one really is 130. That's what's going to pertain for the 2010 school taxes and 11 county and town taxes. But honestly, the other numbers are essentially placeholders. We know that we will be renegotiating before those numbers actually show up on a tax bill. So, okay. Correct?
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah.
But so did the committee look at any possible triggers to have this start going back up?
Specific triggers?
Because it's based on income, we have asked, and AES has already agreed to provide additional information on an annual basis. So as we know that the market is changing, if we see it, if you see it in your electric bill and it goes up to 12 cents, you can be guaranteed we'll be talking to AES, okay? Or the committee will. I don't think I'm going to be on that anymore, but the committee in existence will take up the model and look at it. So there's a lot of public data that will be able to trigger the knowledge base to start asking the right questions. And there's an annual review to sit down and just talk about it, find out what's happening in the marketplace. But I think the issue is, going forward for the next few years, are going to be much more related to the regulatory issues, and especially with pollution control and things like that. Because one of the things that Jerry was alluding to was the extraordinary amount of capital that's involved in this business. And to maintain the generation capacity at the plant, you have to be in compliance with the EPA regulations. And there are some very, very large bills coming up that are going to have to be addressed by AES.
Okay, I've got Dave, and then Pam, then Frank, and Pat.
Okay, I just had a question. Probably the committee already knows the answer, but I don't. What's the viability of the plant in today's market? Okay, can it maintain profitability at the current rates? Can it sell its excess product in the marketplace? Being that it's coal generated, you have relatively high expenses to transport coal and so on and so forth.
Okay. I just want to make sure I can frame the question. So I'm going to repeat. Our excess product, okay, is that referring to electricity? Or, because Steve mentioned, or Joe might have also mentioned the fact that we have some excess land or something. I just want to make sure.
No, I'm talking about the electricity itself.
Yeah. Could you speak right into the mic?
Yeah, I have to get in my cheerleading stance. Okay, excess product. There is no excess product. Okay, we offer every single day our entire product to the market. Okay,
it's stepped in, right, based on how many megawatts we offer. But we offer all of our megawatts. If they take it, we sell it all. If they don't take it, we don't sell it all.
So therefore you shut down, don't generate it?
Well, we back off.
Okay.
Now, what happened in 2009 is we actually shut down.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And how does generating electricity with coal float in today's market on a cost per kilowatt basis? Can you sell your product at your relatively high cost? How you know what I'm saying?
I think I understand your question. You can get information off from the New York ISO website that'll tell you where the current price of energy is on a minute basis.
Okay.
Okay, so you can see that data. It's live data. So how do we compare against nuclear or coal or hydro? The market is fairly complicated on how you're dispatched. But there's a section of the market that's like must-run generation. So nuclear really doesn't compete for us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're must-run. They're on. Hydros are on. So the piece of the economic puzzle, as the energy demand shrinks, becomes less and less. And that's the difficulty that we're seeing.
Okay?
Natural gas tends to set the price of electricity. They're highly correlated.
Okay.
And Steve alluded to that earlier.
Thank you.
Pam.
iPad.
Frank.
Thanks. Jerry, I don't know if this one's for you or for Steve. The two questions. Can you say you have other plants, AES owns other plants. Can you say how what is the generating fuel for those plants? Is it also coal?
In New York? New York it's coal. Coal only.
How many plants do you have in New York?
Four.
Plus, so is it four plus Millikan, or is it four?
Four, including the plant I'm at, ESQ.
And they're all coal-fired?
Yes.
The other plants that you own, are they coal-fired all? The ones outside of New York?
We have combined cycles. That's natural gas. We have several coal plants. We have hydros. We have wind. We have solar. We have biomass. It's a pretty large portfolio.
So you have a whole spectrum.
Yeah.
Are you shutting down, or have you seen a drop in capacity at the other four plants, at the other three plants in New York?
Yes. Yeah. The plant in Binghamton, AES Westover, was off for months.
I thought, and Steve, this one's for you. Did I hear you say that in valuing this, that it would be tough to peddle a coal-fired plant? You didn't say it quite that way, but that's what I thought I heard you say.
Yeah, I think that given the risks that are coming up in the near future, unless a plant is fully compliant with all EPA regulations and anticipated EPA regulations, I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to sell.
The reason I ask is some of us were around when they retrofitted Millikan twice.
Right.
And my understanding was that it met every single regulation known to man. The scrubbers on that stack were state of the art.
That was
We were buying low sulfur coal.
Yeah.
Shipping stuff, or they were buying.
I'll let Jerry answer because it gets into SOX and NOX and all sorts of things.
SOX and NOX?
Yeah. But at the time that you were involved in it, they did meet the regulations for at least one of the generators. But I'll let Jerry get into the details of it.
You just have to finish your sentence by saying at that time. We are faced with CO2 regs, mercury regs, water regs, fly ash. I don't know if you've been looking in the papers.
I remember
lately.
When they used to use the fly ash to make gypsum and make the make board out of it. They used to ship it out and make.
Your memory's pretty good. It's gypsum to make wallboard.
Wallboard.
Fly ash is used in cement.
So that plant is completely shut down now? Not generating anything?
Oh, no. We're fully running right now. But there was 10 days last year where it was completely shut down. And one of the units was off for about 5 weeks.
And I heard Steve say that he would help negotiate any price for kilowatt hour that we needed help with, right? Is that what I heard you say? Thank you, Jerry.
Pat.
Thanks.
This isn't a question so much as a comment. As a representative of the large share of the town of Lansing, and having recently campaigned out there, I can say that the question of the future of AES in Lansing has been very high on the radar for many people that I spoke to as I was on the campaign trail. And as this situation has progressed to the point that it's at now, it's very clear that it's going to be extremely painful, particularly for the taxpayers in the town of Lansing, this renegotiation of the pilot, and particularly for the school district because of the change, the downward change. It's going to be a struggle to try to figure out how to fill that gap. At this point, for next year, there is still some federal stimulus money coming in to the school district. But this coming year is the last year of that unless Congress decides to renew some of that funding. So the Lansing School District is really going to be in very tough straits as a result of this renegotiation. Having said that, I think the other side of the picture is that the thing that people have been most concerned about and have spoken quite openly with me about is that the plant was simply going to close. And there is, I think, as difficult as this situation is, I think that there's going to be at least some sense of relief that there's nothing, at least, that we're seeing right now that indicates that in the near future that that's the case, that we don't see anything in this agreement that would indicate anything except that AES at this point is struggling to get through a very difficult period and is trying to work together with the county to do that. And so as difficult as it's going to be, I think that there will be a lot of people who will be pleased to hear that at least AES will still be there for the foreseeable future.
Thank you for that perspective, Pat. I appreciate that. Will, and then very briefly, Frank.
As was mentioned before, I had the opportunity to go out with Pat yesterday and have a very, very informative tour. And I want to thank you, Jerry, for taking the time to answer my questions, which I'm sure maybe seemed not as well informed as you might, but I certainly learned a lot. And I would encourage all of us, if you haven't taken if you haven't ever seen the plant, go in and see it. It's a pretty amazing operation. It is a lot of stuff's happening, and the fact that it seems to be happening so well is a testament to Jerry and his crew that's keeping it running. Frank, you asked about the production of gypsum. Jerry, my understanding is you're still doing that, right? You're still pumping it out. There is great potential for that plant to have some other industrial facilities, perhaps adjacent. Cogeneration using some of the excess steam and water. They have land. And I think long-term, that's certainly something that has potential. The other thing that I think is important to know is that because of the huge investment that was made early, as coal facilities go, this is a very clean facility, relatively speaking. And Dooley, I know you and I have talked, but I hope you can concur on this. Coal has problems. It's not the ideal fuel, but it would be sad for this plant to leave for all kinds of reasons. And so reluctantly, I find I'm convinced of the need to keep it viable, and I am inclined to put my trust in the negotiating committee for having done a good job of verifying the information on which it's based. But I would encourage other people to go out and tour that if you would like to know more.
Thank you, Will. Frank and Jim.
Thanks, Martha. Jerry, Steve, thank you. It's a good report with sometimes you don't want to shoot the messenger, right? But Joe and David, I'm hearing David's concern about we got to cover these taxes if, heaven forbid, something happens there. What other alternative do we have? Would you care to speculate?
Well, I think you've heard what the alternatives are. If the tax is excessive and they can't pay those taxes, we're on the hook to pay everybody's taxes. So that's not an alternative that I think is very attractive. If we were to bail out of the pilot, if we were to stop doing the pilot and go back to the old days, then the volatility we're seeing right now wouldn't happen in phases. They'd happen abruptly. So if there's a change in value, such as we're seeing right now, it wouldn't be phased in over 4 years or 3 years. It would be phased in immediately. So we would feel the full effect of that reduction in value immediately. Right. So this, to me, is a better glide path in terms of, you know, it's a very volatile industry we're talking about, and better that we have a gentle sloping change in the schedule than to ride that roller coaster and have that volatility that we have to experience every year. So, I think you asked the question, the negotiating team asked itself, you know, what are the alternatives, and I think what has been presented is our view of what the best alternative is.
Thanks, Joe.
And I think Steve had a brief picture of litigation, what that looks like, and that's just throwing money away, as far as I can tell. Jonathan, you had your hand up a while ago.
That was before, but I will respond to this. I have a couple things. One, the alternative of not negotiating in response is just catastrophic for both sides. Like Steve says, we're approaching $1 million, and it's every year for both sides, and it's the cost of doing it and the uncertainty and not finding out till 4 or 5 years later what the amount is. It's just not a real viable option. So given the general thought that you better do this by agreement, I would trust the negotiating team, because the alternative really is a disaster, both for the company and for us. What I actually had my hand raised is in response to Mike's question way back. With regard to pilot agreements, and I can't say for sure this, but I'm 99% sure, in the past when other companies have purchased companies with pilot agreements, they have to get an approval from the IDA for it to continue. Because the agreement is with the company and it doesn't run with the land. And I think that's true now, too. So I think the answer to your question, if another company would buy it, we would have no agreement with them. They would essentially have to come and ask us to continue this agreement.
Thank you.
And I would add that this whole business is an IDA decision. It is not actually a legislature vote. It's not a vote of the school district or the town. All this tonight is a part of public information, because this affects every taxpayer in the county. So we were interested in doing this, and I'm really glad it worked out. But that's one thing. I would also like to say that this is the question of the underutilized land and the excess steam, et cetera, and the opportunities that are at that site. That's something Michael Stamm could have told us a little bit more about, but there's a lot going on, a lot of people talking about how to take advantage of those opportunities, and so we really all have an interest in making sure this plant is strong and can move forward. So, Jim and Nathan.
You answered the question I was going to ask. Who are the decision makers on this agreement?
Okay, that was easy. Nathan.
Do we need to go into executive session?
We thought we might, if there was any question that Jerry felt was, in particular, Jerry felt was too sensitive. I think, is there anything else?
Well, if not, I just wanted to say that I'm glad that we didn't, because there's always the urge to whenever you're talking about something with sensitive information like this. I think it's great that we're keeping this in the public and talking about it in an open way. So thank you.
Well, that's a real testament to Jerry. I think this is his business, and we really this is exactly what Steve and Joe were talking about the good faith effort and the corporate citizenship. And I want to I thank everybody for participating in this, and especially Jerry for being so open with everybody.
Just a point of order. We've had a discussion. We've heard from two representatives, from Steve and Jerry, and we've heard the pluses and minuses. Are we going to learn anything more between now and the next meeting of this board? Is it possible for us just to vote on this tonight?
Is there anything else? The resolution that was pulled,
is there any reason why we wouldn't proceed with this evening and then just move on?
That's the sense of the body. Pam.
Well, it's a long tradition here to extend things for till the last excruciating moment possibly. So, I'm not sure that we have the ability to pass it tonight, but I think that's
be a leader,
thought.
Pam. Put it back on the agenda.
New world, Pam.
Plow new ground.
Well,
someone could move to add it and have 10 votes, and if people want to do that, I'm not saying.
I'll move to add it.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Pat seconds. Okay. Let's see. So that's the motion on the floor. Will, that's what we're discussing, whether to add it.
I would not want to break from tradition, but I also think there's some value to actually letting this simmer a little while. It's a very complex situation. We got Joe's report. I would really like to read that and try to make sure that I fully understand that. And I think I would encourage the public to pay attention to this because the implications are going to be huge, and to contact us. Not that we have the say. All we are actually essentially doing is saying that we understand the situation and give it our blessing, but we don't really have the say. But I still think it would be worthwhile to wait. So I would encourage us to vote against adding it back.
Brian?
I guess I would echo that only in so far as the only thing that's come out in the media really that I've seen has to do with Lansing and has to do with the Lansing School District. And certainly some of my constituents may not realize the effect that it may have on them. Unless there's something in this agreement that needs to be acted upon in 2 weeks, I guess I would be in favor of just getting a little more study and we can vote on it then.
Julie?
I would rather us not add it back at this point. I had a question about the letter that you shared with us that you sent to Jerry Goodnow on December 1st. That letter references the IDA attorneys pointing out that there is a need to modify some language in the agreement, changing the date. Mm-hmm. And I would like to be a bit more aware of what that change might be specifically before we vote on this. So I don't expect you to answer anything about that tonight, but it made me think about wording changes.
Well, that has to do with the fact that we've already passed the first adjustment period, and so this just changes, in a sense, the technical changes the date in the document in the original pilot, so that the deadline for service of that notice, goes on.
It's June 1st, 2010.
Right, that's right.
And that would also give either side an opportunity to reopen with respect to specifics.
I think that the spirit and the letter of this letter is that we are already on notice that we're going to reopen this before June 1st, 2010. That's sort of redundant, as a matter of fact. So, and that's really into the weeds kind of stuff. Jim and Pam?
The resolved in this resolution only says that the legislature supports the renegotiation of the original pilot pursuant to procedure and conditions as outlined in the 227-08 agreement, and it has the new numbers in. I think the best course of action is to see if you have 10 votes to get it on the legislature or on the agenda and go from there.
Pamela and Carolyn.
Well, in spite of my poor attempt at humor, I do think that this, even though the language is pretty broad in terms of what we'll be doing, I think we should wait until our next meeting, because I think I'm hoping that something will get in the press about this and that people will become more aware of it. As other people have said, we need to make sure that our constituents out there understand what's at stake here and get their questions answered. So I will not vote to put it back on the agenda for tonight.
Carol and then Nathan.
Yeah, I would prefer not to put it on the agenda as well. I would prefer when it does come back to us that the committee make an attempt to put in our resolutions, become a permanent record of what our concerns are and some of what the background was. And I think that there is more about the background, how we came to this, the fact that there is an annual reopener, and maybe further resolving that there be an annual report to the legislature from the negotiating.
We'll be happy to work on the language.
Yeah, so if we deal with this tonight, I'm going to be introducing amendments to those regards tonight.
That's a threat.
So. That settles that. Nathan?
You know that.
Nathan?
When does the IDA meet to discuss this?
The public hearing is February, I think, 16th. In the town hall, town of Lansing. So if we vote on it February 2nd, that's in plenty of time to be on the record.
Yeah, that's fine.
For the public hearing.
I can support that course of action.
Okay. All right, we're ready to vote on whether to add this to the agenda tonight. All in favor of that motion, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Opposed to the motion. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I did it. All right. That fails 5 to 10. So good effort. I mean, good try, Frank. I will say that one thing that people can learn between now and February 2nd is go out to the plan. And please let me know if you would like to do that. And
to do what? I'm sorry.
Go out to the plan. Have a tour with Jerry, and I will let me know so I can kind of cluster those, and we can have one tour that fits as many people as possible. Jim.
Martha, when does the IDA meet for this issue?
It won't talk about this issue. The next meeting is February 5th.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So it won't vote on the pilot. I think we have to actually have a special meeting in February because we have to get this settled by the March 1st status
right.
date.
Okay. So it's sometime.
It has to be after the public hearing.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
And when is their public hearing?
It is set February 16th.
February 16th.
Right. I don't have the time off the top of my head. We'll let you know. Jerry, Steve, thank you very, very much.
Yeah,
really appreciate this. And we'll be in touch. I think I will point the school district and the town to this spot on the webcast when this gets put up on the web so they can see this whole presentation and discussion. Pam.
I move that we adjourn.
Yes, but we have to stick around, please. And
I know. That's why I want to get to it.
All right. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor of adjourning?
All right.
Okay, please get out your calendars and let's have a meeting.
What day are you? Welcome committee.
Find your chairs.
Second Wednesday, 3:30. We all 5 agreed, and Kathy's already got it carved in stone.
Here.
On the calendar.